Fiestas. All right, I'm showing we're live.
Yep, yes, and I just got a message from him, good to go.
All right, everyone. So thank you all for being on time this morning. This will be an interesting experience for all of us, I'm sure, and a long one, but appreciate everyone's attention. Let's see, I have something I'm supposed to read to you. I am calling the virtual meeting of the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council to order. It is the last day of August, August 31st, 2020, at 8:05 in the morning. The meeting is held in accordance with the memo dated April 21st, 2020 from the LCC Chair and Vice Chair regarding commission meetings and being held remotely. You've already seen or heard these procedures. However, for those of you who may be unfamiliar with them, you should try to mute yourself when you're not talking. Please use the raise hand feature if you want to speak, and click lower hand when you're finished speaking. I'll try to see you if you're waving at me, but raising and lowering your hand will do a better job because it shows up yellow on my screen. We're going to use the roll call for votes. I don't think we have any, we may have votes today other than the minutes and agenda, which we can approve without a roll call vote, I'm told. All of the materials are on the website. So before we begin anything, does anyone have any questions? If not, I would love a motion to approve the agenda for today. And actually, if we can approve agenda for all 4 days, that will save us time in the subsequent days. Can I get that motion, please?
So moved.
Is there any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye or put your thumbs up.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. You were sent the minutes of our last meeting. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
McNamara moves approval.
Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye or put your thumb up.
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. We have 4 days of hearings. If anyone has any conflicts with any of the hearings that would keep them from participating, can you please let us know now?
Mr. Chair, I think we have an environment finance meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to navigate through both of those. I've notified Peter Strohmeyer that their meeting is a conflict with ours. So
okay,
we'll take it 1 minute at a time.
There's a couple of us on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any conflicts with the proposals was what I was really asking for, but I appreciate knowing you might step off as well. I, for one, am conflicted on the Audubon proposals and will not be doing anything other than making sure they present. I'll ask no questions, nor will I vote on any of the proposals.
I'm also have a conflict of interest with the Audubon proposals, so I won't be weighing in on those.
All right, any others? Hearing none, we'll assume those are the only conflicts. Amanda, did we have any written public comments?
Mr. Chair, members, we did not at this point in time.
Okay. So let's talk for a moment about what we think we're going to have in terms of money to spend or recommend being spent. Mark, do you want to handle this? And maybe Jamie, as our treasurer, you can weigh in.
Yeah, I sure can, Mr. Chair. I'll just give a quick overview and Jamie can chime in also. The there's a memo in your in the materials that you were able to take a look at. The MMB got back to us and gave us kind of a list of scenarios, which is on the second page of that memo. They also said that you know, because things are kind of up in the air yet, as far and will be for quite a while with regards to the future economy, 10% reserve was probably going to be a good place to start. We reached out to House Fiscal and Senate Fiscal Analysis, Brad Hagermeyer and Dan Mueller, respectively, and they both got back, and it's also listed in the memo that their thoughts were that being more conservative was definitely a better idea. So seemingly in that 10% or better range, the or 10% range anyway. There's also a list on the second page of the memo that gives you an idea of what the reserves have been in the past, also what the differences have been in the reserve from the original recommendation. And of course, last year, for those of you, or for all of us, I guess we can remember that there was quite some significant changes because of the economy unrest and the way things turned out, especially in February. So with regards to that memo, there's a suggestion from staff at starting at that 10%. And I know that Jamie had a chance to look over some of these figures as well, and I'm sure that our treasurer might have a comment or two as well.
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, David. Yeah, we reviewed the information from previous years as well as this year. What we saw was a recommendation from Dan and Brad with the 10%, as Mark mentioned, and thinking through a good goal, we thought that the shock of the revenues from last year, we had to be reactive. And so since the most of the recent forecast has had the opportunity to count for that, that we should be able to be more confident in the 7 to 10% range, but really up to the council if we want to do more or less.
Mr. Chair, if I may also add for the members' information, within the memo, there's a recommendation at the 10% level. It's the recommendation comes out to be $109.8 million in potentials for recommending for allocation. That amount would have to be reduced then by a couple of things that are kind of constants. One would be the administrative operating budget, which I've had a chance to go over with Jamie and with our treasurer, and that would be the amount of $546,000. And then we have website cost, which this year will be about $4,000 and next year will be $3,000, or let's back that up. Fiscal 22 will be $4,000. The following fiscal, the second year of the biennium, it'll be $3,000. And then we have contracts management, which is a constant for $210,000, and panel, the technical evaluations panel, which is a constant for $150,000. So it reduces that amount by $910,000, which comes up to be about $108.9 million if we look at having a 10% reserve based on the information we have right now from MMB for projections.
Great. So I'll open it up for any discussion about using that as our target amount on the allocations. And just to remind everyone, at this point, there will be an early December forecast, which will allow us to make any last minute changes before our recommendations in January. So we would use this number to make all of our allocation recommendations subject to that adjustment in early December.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Dan here. I would support the 10% reserve. I would also remind folks that the early December forecast that we would base our recommendations on would also then be subject to, by the legislature, the February forecast, which will be the official forecast that's used to determine the revenue available for the bill. So I just want people to keep that in mind, because it is a number that could possibly move a little bit. The other thing that I do, and I'm not going to be in the legislature next year, but we're going to continue to grapple with a budget that is problematic the way it seems. And when we do acquisitions and so forth, we'll be adding an expense to the general fund by the inclusion of PILT for that. And I've advocated a conversation in the past that we should take a look at, you know, putting some money in reserves for PILT out of the money that we are spending. That's kind of not gone anywhere at this point, but in lieu of things the way they are now, I just want people to be aware that could come up again in the future. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great, thanks, Dan. Other comments?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Lang here. I guess I'm just wondering if, like Dan said, and he didn't ask the question, but I'll ask it, is there an intent to come back after the February forecast and do adjustments at that point? Or are you looking first part of the year with the November, December forecast and go from that point?
I guess our question. Thank you. Our recommendations are to, based on the December forecast, we have to submit our recommendations in early January. What has typically happened is if there's any significant adjustment, the legislature comes back and asks our opinion, as they did last year with Ron and I. Unless the legislature comes back and specifically asks us to make some adjustments, we have not done much with the February forecast, and it's been up to the legislature to deal with that. For the most part, the adjustments in February have not moved the bubble enough that there's been any need for a change in our recommendations. And part of the strategy of having a 10% reserve is if the forecast becomes lower in February, there's enough play for us to not have to make adjustments as we did this year, as the legislature did this year. Since by law, we're required to keep 5% reserve. Mark, do you have something you want to add to that?
Mr. Chair, just a couple of things for all the members to understand is that the reserve, of course, we all realize there's a 5% mandated reserve from statute. So, and that is for the forecast closest to for the most recent forecast, I think is how it's listed in law. So it would be the February forecast, unless there's a special forecast afterwards. The other thing is that the reserve that the council has pretty much tried to stay close to that 5% reserve come the January recommendations. Last year we did that, and then we saw that it tanked, or the economy really dipped afterwards. So we had to go back and figure out how to reduce, and everybody got about across the board cut. If the reserve the council lays out, let's say it were to stay at 10%, and we really only needed a 5% come February, that extra 5% doesn't need to be spent. It can roll into the next year, and it will be available then to be spent. It's not like it becomes inaccessible afterwards. And the last thing I was going to mention was that in the memo, some of you have maybe seen that Mr. Hagemeyer and Mr. Mueller from House and Senate Fiscal have both mentioned that it's easier to add back dollars into appropriations, in other words, start from a more conservative aspect, than it is from a less conservative when it comes to February, if the analysis for the economy were to be different at that point and the reserve were to be reprojected?
So any other comments? Mark, do we need a formal motion to use that as the target?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we do. We can just do consensus, but and it could be changed later. This is really a kind of a benchmark or just a placeholder at this point. And then of course we have to see come November, but it'll give us a chance to kind of lock in those figures, figure out about where the money is going to go, about where the money is going to be recommended to go as far as how the council feels. And then we can adjust that in November or the December meeting when we get the next forecast.
So in essence, the allocation sheet that you were sent had this number plugged in, and hearing no objection, we're going to use that allocation sheet to do all of our work. I would assume that whatever motions we make at the end of this process will be based on that number, and we'll just go forward. Denny, you raised your hand.
Mr. Chair, what I'm wondering is, would we want to have at least a limited discussion that whether we start here, or I could even understand where we might start with a 15% reserve, would our thoughts be at this point as we look at things that if we have, say, a 5 or 2% or 6% change come December, that should we be looking at all these projects with the thought that that would be across the board cut that we would be thinking about? Or are we thinking that we may potentially meet in December and have strategic cuts? I guess that's more a discussion question, just thinking out loud what our thoughts would be. I mean, I guess I would think that we would, I'm not sure. That's what I'm actually wondering.
I would think that we're going to have to take December and decide in December what we do, because figuring out what we do now in December, having no idea what we'll face, it's really hard, both in terms of potentially excess money or something that doesn't square with our 10% reserve discussion we're having this morning. Denny.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that sounds fine, but would we want to consider then any larger reserve? Would we want to do a 15% and only go at 103 million or something now, with the idea that it would be, that gives us even more flexibility to add back more? That'd be my only question. I guess I would support even going bigger. That would give us a chance to add back in, but I'm fine with whatever everybody else wants.
Personally, I would keep it at the 10% and face whatever issue we have to in December, but it's up to the group at large. Anyone feel strongly about doing anything different than the recommended amount from staff and your treasurer? All right. So Denny, I hope it's okay if we start with the 10% and we'll go from there. Great, thank you. So we'll now get into the hearings. I will attempt as best I can to keep everybody to 5 minutes with 10 minutes of questions. If it seems like there's an issue that comes up that we need to really work through that takes more time, we will take the time. We'll hopefully make that up with some of the proposals that are repeats that don't take as much time. We are going to have a little break as we talk about the roving crews. We put them on the agenda first, both the proposal for just funding roving crews as well as then proposals that include the roving crews, to try to move that to a place where we know what we're doing. And then get on with all the rest of the proposals. Are there any questions about how we're going to try to make this work? Well, let's see what we can do here. So I think we have Greg Hoke on the line to talk about the roving crew proposal, proposal 01.
Okay, just to check that somebody can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you both chairs and members for this invitation to appear here this morning to present DNR's 01 roving crew proposal. My name is Greg Hoke, and I'm the Prairie Habitat Supervisor with the Minnesota DNR. This year, we're submitting a single proposal that will cover all five of the roving crews. We would like to eventually get these onto a two-year cycle, but given the economics of the time, this year we have informally amended our request from $9 million down to $4.5 million, as described in an earlier memo from Kelly Wilder on the 19th. With these dollars, we anticipate enhancing over 25,000 acres of grassland, wetland, and forest habitat across the state. The Roving Crew program at the DNR started with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The program has grown from one crew in the Northwest to now five crews across the state. Because we've added them one at a time, they've been split among different proposals and appropriations. To add to the complexity, the original three crews were split between the DNR grassland enhancement proposals that I present and the wetland enhancement proposals that Ricky Lamb presents. And then last, the crews are always one part of the larger grassland and wetland enhancement proposal, which included other components. So to review, the Northwest Roving Crew was initially funded under ML-10, the Southwest Crew under ML-11, and the Southeast Crew under ML-12. Then more recently, the council has funded a West Central Crew with ML-19, and then most recently, a Northeast Forest Crew with ML-20. So, at the request of the chair, the DNR gave a presentation at the January council meeting. At that time, we were asked to simplify and consolidate our request. We welcome this opportunity and think this new model will make the roving crew proposals easier to communicate, will make the crews more effective in their habitat work, and more efficient in terms of budgeting and planning. There will be an adjustment as we switch from an old model to a new model, and the DNR would work closely with council staff to be transparent about what we're doing and how we're doing it. Although the crews are centrally located within the areas, they are able to travel widely. So for instance, if one county is too rainy in the summer or in the winter, it doesn't get cold enough to freeze the ground, crews can shift their efforts to other counties within the state. For bigger projects, multiple crews can consolidate into one larger crew, and this flexibility really allows the crews to be very efficient with everything they're doing. Now, while prescribed fire is where the crews gain their biggest acreage, they also conduct tree removal projects on the prairie, harvest prairie seed for restorations, reestablish wild rice in new lakes and wetlands, and a variety of other projects. So let me just share a couple of recent projects the crews have worked on. Last year, the Region 1 crew up in the Northwest completed a 7,350-acre burn on August 8th on Pool 3 of Roseau River WMA. The intent was to burn a dry sedge meadow to knock back brush encroachment and to remove standing cattails in the pool for fall migrating waterfowl. After the burn, the site received record rainfalls that flooded the impoundment. This spring, staff noticed that all the burnt cattails had flooded out due to the high water, and the site has now returned to wild rice. In another example from the southern part of the state on a WMA near Wilmer, in September of 19, the Region 4 or Southwest Roving Crew seeded a small wetland with wild rice. This year, the seeding erupted with fantastic results, and the area manager reported to me last week that currently their blueing teal have grouped up and found the site to be a great home with good cover and lots of food. So the roving crews have been actively involved with both cattail spraying from the DNR helicopter as well as the new airboat, and Ricky will talk about those a little bit more in following proposals. So these crews are also, in addition to all of that work, are able to provide additional resources to the state of Minnesota. They're highly trained and qualified in a range of specialized skills and equipment use. While we try to keep them on habitat work all year long, there are rare occasions, such as an especially bad wildfire season in the state, where crews are pulled off of OHF dollars temporarily and used for wildfire suppression. As soon as that's done, they then quickly go back onto OHF funding. So thank you for working with the DNR to develop this new funding model. We're proud of our roving crews and what they've been able to accomplish, and we're thankful for your past support. This new model will allow us to be more efficient and enhance more acres across Minnesota's habitats. And with that, I'd be happy to address any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. excuse me, Mr. Hulk, I received a phone call earlier in the summer from a person in the private sector who was concerned about an upcoming meeting. And can you enlighten me on how you work with the private sector? Isn't there some sort of an advisory group that the DNR works with? This individual was concerned that the private sector was kind of being, I'll just put words in his mouth, being squeezed out of the roving crew and the burning, the technical stuff that's going on with regards to the burns. Can you help me out there, please? I think Member McNamara is also familiar with the individual and their concern.
Yeah, the roving crew occasionally will work with contractors, but that's really what we'll be addressing in my second proposal, as well as some other DNR proposals, where the roving crews are relatively a compact group, and they do their own thing. But then in our grassland, wetland, and forest enhancement proposals, that's where we're really talking about doing projects that maybe the roving crew doesn't have the exact specific equipment that is needed for a specific project. That's then when we will work with local contractors in the state.
Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hulk, are you, I would think that we would want to include language in this year's bill that would give you total flexibility for the outstanding allocations so that you, would you consider that? I would think we should clear that up so that we let you have total flexibility immediately with the movement, not only with this money, or is that assumed you're getting that? I'm just wondering, why wouldn't we include rider language to allow that? And I'm surprised you didn't ask for that if you didn't. Maybe I missed it.
Yeah, Greg?
Yeah, Chair and members, yeah, a lot of that was covered in that memo from Kelly Wilder that she sent to staff on the 19th, where we kind of laid out an economic model of how we would do that transition. And I know that, you know, in that January meeting, you know, it was pretty clear direction from the council to, you know, we've been fairly strict with ourselves on only working on specific types of projects and specific type of habitats. And we thought, you know, it's fairly clear that, you know, really open it up so that let these crews, as long as they're doing good work and it's being done in a cost-effective and strategic way, to kind of let them go and do whatever. So in the past, the prairie crews were only allowed to work on prairie and wetland work. Where in this model, you know, if there's a need, they could be working on some forest or brushland type projects.
So David has a question, but just to follow up on that, you know, I was confused as well, because if we were to allow you with existing appropriations, essentially become the roving crew of the future, through language we put in there, it would seem like your $4.5 million a year going forward amount would not be all required in the first year, and that didn't seem to be addressed. So I want you to address whatever Senator Tomasoni has as well, but I would like you to follow through on that as well.
Yeah, Chair and members. So the memo that we sent on the 19th, and there was a lot of rounding, and obviously this is a quickly moving situation. And yeah, as far as the exact precise, you know, this is a lot of forecasting. Again, we would just work very, very closely with Mark and other staff to be very transparent once we kind of see how this process evolves on exactly what we're doing and exactly how we're going to be doing it.
But just to follow up, so what, you know, you need $4.5 million a year. You're going to have some carry forward. Give us an amount, or we're going to have to make a decision on our own as to what to give you less than the $4.5 million, which you don't want to have us do. If that's the will of the council, what are you going to have in 2022 fiscal year remaining from existing proposals that can be reallocated if we put the right language in the bill is the question.
Yeah, so we think currently, our chair and members, we think currently there is probably about a, you know, we said $4.5 million to cover per year, and we basically said in that memo that there's basically, you know, $5 million hanging out there for lack of a better term. So we could take a smaller reduction. And I'm assuming then, I guess, if we did go that way, we would need to submit quickly to council staff a revised proposal that didn't have the $9.1 million. And at that point in time, then we would be able to go through and again working with staff and come up with a very detailed number. But yeah, there's a lot of rounding and a lot of kind of trying to project in that memo. So we didn't want to try to get down to the exact dollar and cent in that. Just the nature of trying to look forward and economically.
All right, David, go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Greg, I think I heard you say you planted some wild rice and you had a bumper crop this year. Can you just give me an idea where you planted it and was it just the summer that happened to be the right summer for a bumper crop? Because it seems to me that wild rice was growing really well this summer. And just curious about your judgment on this.
Chair and members, this has been an excellent year for wild rice. I've been hearing good reports across the state. I'd actually like to defer that question to and another two speakers. Ricky will be presenting on the grassland enhancement. Ricky's really the rice expert in the state, and he can give you a much more precise answer than I would be able to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mark, you have a comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on David's comment a moment ago, his question. I think and Greg may want to come back to this later, but I think he'd said that there was an area of cattails that had been treated and burned, and that's where it came back with wild rice quite well. Greg, maybe you could correct me, but just to put this into, try to encapsulate it a little bit, in the proposal, in the latest memo that Kelly had provided us with regards to the roving crews, it broke out a little bit more of the budget. And what you're looking here in year one, which is this proposal for the roving crew, would really be $4.5 million. And then you'd be using about $4.5 million in residual funds that would have to be amended in the appropriation or in the accomplishment plan. And I don't know if that would take legal language in law for this bill or not, but that's at least what I remember us talking about, was a $4.5 million recommendation, and then also $4.5 million from existing dollars that would come in to cover. And then next year, you'd come back with a $9 million appropriation that would cover 2 years. So, and then we'd skip a year and so on. Maybe you could clarify all that for us just a little bit, please.
Yeah, so chair and members, again, I'm looking at that memo from Kelly from a couple of weeks ago. And so, for instance, you know, we've been funding these 3 years at a time. So we do have some money, that has already been appropriated for FY22 and 23. So, for instance, looking at the memo, some of the monies for the Region 3 roving crew in the Southeast, which we kind of have earmarked for FY23, we could take those monies and move them up to cover Region 4, the Southwest crew, for FY22. And basically, that would then fill out FY22. There's still then, according to this, $700,000 hanging out there from the forest roving crew. And again, there's a lot of rounding here. So that $700,000 is, with a lot of rounding, that's kind of where that $500,000 difference is between you know, what we have out there versus what we need. And so that money, we could do a couple of things. That money could be reallocated within its current appropriation towards contract work. Or again, we could kind of start with that $4.5 million in our kind of revised request for this year and reduce it a little further down to roughly $4 million or maybe just a little below that.
Denny, you had your hand up. Did you still have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just thanks Mark, Director Johnson, for clarifying that it could be fixed in the accomplishment plan so that we give the DNR the clarity to be able to put the people where the work needs to get done. I would not want to see us reduced to $4.5 million at all. I believe this and the CPL grant program are the two most important things we do. And it would be my hope that at the end of this discussion that we move to fund this whole $4.5 million right now and then deal with it kind of looking that we have 104 point whatever million left to do all our allocations. Because I think this one is really, really important that we get it in the CPL. I thought we were potentially going to have that discussion. And Mr. Chair, I guess it'd be a question for you. It'd be my hope that we think about how we fund this one right away, if that's an issue or not. Maybe I missed that.
Yeah, that's the intent. The question I'm trying to understand is there's already in the upcoming fiscal year, FY22, $5 million that's going to roving crews. And they're asking for another $4.5 million, which would more than fund the FY23 amount, since there's already $1.6 million in FY23 that's been allocated from prior amounts. So I'm struggling with what the $4.5 million is really for if we were to create whatever scenario there is to allow them to reallocate existing resources to the a broad roving crew proposal instead of regional roving crews. And that's the piece I don't understand and would like clarification on.
Yeah, so again, to Sharon members, again, I'm going back to Kelly's memo. So again, you know, what we're asking for with the $4.5 million, which I think is what you just said, Mr. Hartwell, is we're going to use the existing appropriated funds to cover ourselves in FY22, and then use this $4.5 million to cover ourselves in FY23. And then at that point in time, then we'll kick over to requesting basically $9 million every other year. So part of asking for just a straight $4.5 million to cover FY23, there's a little bit of accounting simplicity there, that in FY23, we can just basically, you know, stop what we're doing with the old ones, start on this new appropriation. And then any monies that are left over after FY22, as 22 is proceeding, we can work with council staff as far as retasking that into contract and supply work, or potentially returning that money to the council for future allocations.
Mark?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. So just for a little bit of clarity, Greg can correct me if I'm wrong, but in a little more simple words, this type of funding, as I understand it, provides a one-year overlap so that there's some assurance in the employment of those roving crews that at least if we don't get a bill or something obscure happens, that one-year funding, at least for the next year, continues. And Greg, you please correct me if I'm wrong with that.
Yeah, Chair and members. And so what we've done with kind of our long-term forecasting, again, going back to Kelly's memo, is we're always kind of asking for 1 year out, even when we get to the two-year cycle. And again, that's just for kind of stability among the crews. It makes the crews a little happier that they know that they've got, you know, more guaranteed funding as opposed to, geez, I know I've got 12 months of funding and then, you know, something could happen. You know, these are relatively reliable funds, but there could be a legislative or economic hiccup somewhere where the crews, where this specific appropriation or, you know, all of them for some reason don't get funded. So we're always kind of building ourselves into a buffer year so that there is, if there is some really bad event that something happens, then we've got a kind of a year to catch up to keep the crews going. And so again, that's really kind of a job security type of measure that we were thinking of that, yeah, always asking kind of 1 year out.
So the question really is, if you have funding for FY22 of the 5 million and you have $1.6 million for FY23 already, if those are reallocated to general purposes, why wouldn't this request be for 3 million for FY23 instead of for 4.5?
Oh yeah, yeah, Chair and members, I've been misunderstanding your question, Mr. Hartwell. So the 5 million on Kelly's memo covers all of the red numbers. So that's all, that's including that 1.6 over there at FY23. So I'm sorry, we weren't clear on that. So yeah, the 5 million covers all of the red numbers, including the 930 and the 710 out there in FY23. Yeah, apologize for lack of clarity there.
That must be how you do new math, adding two columns at the same time. All right. Any other questions on the general proposal here? So let's move into PRE 01B, which is DNR Grassland Phase 10 with and I assume without the roving crew. Greg?
Yeah, so again, Chair and members, thank you yet again. And yes, I will be making this proposal based on kind of the idea that this is without the roving crew, just so I will be making a single proposal. And so this is just the 01B. So again, thank you for the invitation to appear today to present the DNR's PRE 01B Grassland Enhancement Proposal. We are requesting $7.1 million to restore and enhance roughly 13,000 acres, primarily on WMAs, SNAs, and Native Prairie Bank easements through work with local contractors. The proposal is a companion to the previous proposal on roving crews. While roving crews do get a lot done, they can't be everywhere at once to do all the habitat enhancement on DNR lands. Each year, we're getting better and better at determining what projects can most effectively and efficiently be completed by a roving crew versus by a local contractor. In some cases, local contractors have specialized equipment that the roving crew don't have, or a project may be several hours from the nearest roving crew. It may be more cost-effective to hire a local contractor than to pay the local crews to travel to and overnight stays if there aren't any other projects for the crews to work on that same trip. So one common question is whether the results of OHF-funded projects are permanent and long-lasting. In the case of some enhancement, the answer is simply no. We burn a WMA and we'll need to burn it again in a few years. In other cases, the enhancements are permanent, such as removing trees from grassland areas. We have improved our methods over the years which eliminates or minimizes follow-up treatments and saving money in the long time. Where we are making our most permanent, lasting legacy on the landscape is with our restorations. Historically, habitat projects included a couple of species of grass and a couple of species of wildflowers, and we often had no idea where that seed came from. Today, there's a much stronger focus on using local seed adapted to local soils and climates, and we're often using 40, 60, 80 species seed mixes, which is highly beneficial for both pollinators and wildlife. I'll then repeat from the earlier that all the work under this appropriation and related proposals is guided by our state's wildlife and habitat plans, such as the Prairie Plan, as well as the new Pheasant and Duck Plan. These plans help us focus our work so that we're using our resources most effectively in the most critical parts of the state. I'd like to add that we collectively, the conservation community, take monitoring and our efforts very seriously. This spring, the TNC was the lead author with co-authors from the DNR, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Chicago Botanical Gardens, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the University of Minnesota on a research publication titled Cooperatively Improving Tallgrass Prairie with Adaptive Management. Then this month, just a couple weeks ago, the University of Minnesota and several partners published a research paper on the management of Minnesota prairies. While not directly tied to specific OHF-funded enhancement projects, these and other research and monitoring efforts show collectively how seriously the conservation community takes restoration, enhancement, and the use of these and other funds. Each of these studies allows us to learn more, be more effective, and more efficiently use outdoor heritage funds and other conservation funding. I can relate a couple of ongoing projects. This June, the DNR utilized hand-picked local forb seed that was harvested under a multi-agency, multi-NGO effort. We purchased additional seed from a vendor to add to that mix. Altogether, the site had over 140 wildflower species planted on them. We managed the site strategically in this first year with timed spot clipping to control any invasives. Because the WMA is in what we call the weedy phase of restorations this year, there are large flocks of mourning doves using the area. It's very rare to find a 100-acre field of prime dove hunting in Minnesota, but that's exactly what we've inadvertently done this year. As the restoration proceeds, the site will develop into more suitable habitat for species such as pheasants, nesting waterfowl, and pollinators. However, even in the restoration phase, we managed to create habitat and hunting opportunities. And as another example, this summer I was walking on an SNA in the Minnesota River Valley where some OHF-funded tree removal projects were recently completed. I was walking along, just happened to look down, and saw I was standing in a patch of a dozen or so northern green bog orchids. They probably would not have been there unless the trees and shrubs had been removed. While the goal of this effort is to improve habitat for a wide range of wildlife species, these funds will go directly to small business contractors in the rural part of the state. This will help stimulate rural economies as well as improve habitat. Some of the contractors we've worked with in the past have told us that since starting working on OHF-funded habitat projects, they've hired more employees, they've turned seasonal employees into year-round employees. They also tell us about the pride they take in driving by an AMA or WMA or AMA months or years later and seeing the results of their efforts. As DNR staff work with our contractors, those contractors become more efficient and more familiar with exactly what we're looking for, much more nuanced than simply what we're looking for or what's written in the contract. This again makes both DNR staff and these contractors more efficient and more effective. These dollars are a very good supplement to the roving crew and internal DNR enhancement funds to improve public lands for hunting, pollinators, and multiple other benefits that these lands provide. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? I'm not seeing any questions. I think we've had enough of you, Greg.
Chair and members, I'll try to take that in a good light. Thank you.
I think you've answered all the questions, which is a great thing. I hope you can take a little humor in the morning. If not, we'll move on to the next proposal, which, if I can get my act together, is Shallow Lakes and Wetland Enhancements by Ricky Lean with the DNR, which is both a roving crew, non-roving crew proposal. Ricky, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me okay? I don't see, can someone wave
yes,
if you're hearing me?
We can
me?
Hear you, okay. We can hear you.
Thank you very much. I apologize, I don't have a headset for better clarity, but thank you for your past support of the programmatic wetland habitat proposals I've submitted. My name is Ricky Lean, and I'm the Wetland Habitat Team Supervisor for the Section of Wildlife Management. I do want to, before I get into my new proposal, briefly acknowledge the recently completed Marsh Lake project that was wrapped up in western Minnesota. That project had two OHF appropriations totaling $4.63 million, and that was part of a total project cost of $13 million. And while it took longer than anyone wanted to see due to annoyingly regular extreme flood events, that project is complete. And by all accounts I've heard, a really good vegetation response has taken hold. The project managers had high hopes for inviting all of you to a project dedication and giving you a chance to see all the pieces of this project firsthand. When we move out of our current restrictions, I hope it can be one of the first things scheduled for you to visit, or maybe we could invite some of the federal and state project managers to come speak to you at some point. Looking at projects we currently have in progress, I was going to talk a little bit about our cattail spraying. Greg touched on that. I think in order to move us ahead a little in the schedule, I'll just say with next year's cattail spraying, we're going to pass the 10,000 acre mark for acres of invasive cattails that we've treated with a helicopter that you've helped us outfit. I will talk a little bit about a current activity that some of you have asked about, and that's the work we're doing on Big Rice Lake near Towner, and that's work to reestablish one of Minnesota's truly historic wild rice lakes. Almost as neat as talking about the helicopter we use on cattails, just a few weeks ago, we took possession of our new airboat that was procured with OHF money, and it is now at work at Big Rice Lake 6 days a week. I'll see if I can figure out a way to get some video to council staff to share with all of you so we can get a sense of what's going on and to see this new tool in the toolbox. Switching gears, I'll spend the balance of my time talking about my current proposal. Since Greg Hoke and I are unique in that we bring programmatic proposals in front of you, you'll note that it includes a variety of project types. Since we've already discussed roving crews, and I can talk about what my proposal would be like with that, what I'm going to talk about now is my proposal excluding roving crews, and that means I have two components in my proposal. One is a slate of wetland shallow lake projects requested by our field staff, and the second component is an expansion and acceleration of our new wetland management program. The total request is for $4.25 million. The first component, which is almost two-thirds of the total cost of the proposal, is the slate of individual projects requested by our field property managers. This year's list includes 18 individual projects, plus the funding needed for our annual aerial cattail spraying activities. Of these 18 projects, 8 are to obtain the needed preliminary engineering to get the projects off the ground. There are another 10 projects that would make up this component for which the funding would see actual engineering and construction of the infrastructure, the actual dirt moving stage of work that we all look forward to seeing. I'll spend the last few moments of my time talking about the second component of my proposal, and that's an expansion of the DNR's new wetland management program for which we put our first boots on the ground this year. Recall if you were here last year that we have identified a major need to bring management to small wetlands in the state. Using the Shallow Lakes program as a model, we are creating a similar program to address this need. We were able to create 2 wetland management specialist positions this past year, and I'm here to tell you that this money is well spent, the work is exciting, and we are showing we can get work done if we have the people to do it. Just like the specialists who work on shallow lakes, these wetland management specialists have just 2 jobs: assess small wetlands and bring about needed management. Because there is so much work to do, these people are working in what I would call a target-rich environment. Here are 2 different messages I got from our specialist who is working out of New London. First message was, this WMA had 55 wetland basins on it. 45 of them have never been restored. They all have drainage ditches coming out of them. The very next week, I got a message from at the end of the week saying, I had a great week out in the field. 119 wetland basins were assessed. That was on only 2 WMAs. The greatest single need we have for wetland management in the state is to improve habitat on small wetlands. The requested funding would allow us to expand our new program so that we can bring needed management to even more wetland complexes in the prairies. And with that, I'll conclude my talk. And I know there was a question about wild rice, so I'll let you, Mr. Hartwell, decide whether you want me to talk about that now or see if the question comes up again.
Sure, thank you. David, did you want to ask about wild rice, or has your question been answered? You're on mute.
Mr. Chairman, my question has been answered. Thank you.
All right, great. Other questions for Ricky? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lane, just real quickly, I've had Lakeshore property owners talk to me about their frustration with regards to invasive cattails. I appreciate the work that you and your folks are doing, but it seems that it's very difficult for property owners to remove invasive cattails from their lakeshore property. Is the DNR doing anything to ease those restrictions so that private individuals can kind of join in this fight? You're muted.
Chairman Hartwell and council members, we have aquatic plant managers out on the landscape. And I tell any landowner who calls me with issues, because they somehow get my name, to let me put them in touch with those people. They know the permitting requirements. They know what are effective methods of use. So I would welcome, if any of you get questions about that, to feel free to refer them to me, and I'd be glad to put them in touch with the appropriate aquatic plant management specialist. I'm one of those, I don't like just saying, here's a phone number, call them. I say, here's a phone number, call them. If you don't hear back from them, call me back, and I will reach out to them for you. So I'd be glad to put them in touch with those people to help them out.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, members, our next section here is really to talk about roving crews. Are we interested in funding the roving crews as a separate entity, or do we want to continue to see them as part of other projects in with specific goals related to those projects? I think our discussions at this point have been about giving them more flexibility to go where they need to go versus creating the patchwork that we've created in the past. So assuming we wanted to move in a new direction, the thought was that we would have a discussion about allocating specific funds out of the total for the roving crews. And then when we come to specific allocations, we'd be allocating to these two proposals without the roving crew funds in them, because they would have been covered through the general roving crew proposal. And what we've heard to clarify is that they would like to always be 1 year ahead. So the request is essentially $4.5 million to fund for 2023, since they already have funds covered in 2022 with existing allocations that we've made. This is something Mark and Ron and I spent a fair amount of time working on at your request. We're kind of at a point of, what do we want to do? So I'll open it up to discussion. Jamie.
David, one thing before we jump into that, I just had one question, and maybe I'm alone in this, but I was having difficulty understanding what the remaining funds requested if you remove the roving crew. So the example given previously was that there was an assessment of the wetlands, and then there was the restoration of the wetlands. And so if the roving crews are in charge of the restoration of the wetlands, then is PRE 01 without the roving crew just in office, you know, reviewing you're doing the assessment, sorry, not in the opposite, is it just the assessment of the wetlands and not that, the actual restoration of it, or what is the money being spent on that is left over without the roving crew of this proposal?
I don't know the specific answer, but my assumption is that the two proposals that we saw, PRE-01A and PRE-01B, one is with the roving crew included and one is without, so that work would be divided out. Same would be true for the the WRE-01A and B in terms of that, but I don't know exactly what would come on which side of the ledger if we were to go ahead with a roving crew only type proposal. Mark, do you have any sense, or are presenters still around?
Mr. Chair, we're checking with Ricky. He signed out, but we'll try to get a hold of him and get him back in here. Perhaps Amanda could check if Greg Hoke is still on or somebody else from DNR who could answer that question. Otherwise, I'll continue to try to get hold of Ricky quick.
Yeah, I just let Greg back into the meeting. Greg, are you with us?
Yes, I am back. Chair and members. There are a couple of there are some slight differences between the wetland enhancement and the prairie enhancement. And I'll let Ricky, if he's still out there, speak to wetlands. So the 7.1 that we would be asking for the prairie restoration, that money is pretty much going to go completely. Oh, there we go. That money will go completely towards contracts and supplies. So basically hiring contractors to do the work out there, and then supplies for us is primarily seed for additional either restorations or enhancements. Ricky, so that's the prairie one, is it's a little simpler than we had roving crew and contract work. And then Ricky has a couple of other things with his small wetland and his shallow lakes program. And if Ricky's still out there, he can speak more to those than I can.
All right. I don't see Ricky in the queue or on the call.
Well, Chair and members, I can take a shot at it. Please. So with Ricky's proposal, he's funding both some of the contract work, some of the wetland enhancement work that he was discussing, as well as funding both the shallow lakes and his small wetland program. And I just got an instant message here from Judy Schulte, who usually is literally sitting at my shoulder during these proposals. So some of the work under the Ecological and Water Resources Division for some of the SNA work, there is a little bit of staff money in there to hire basically laborers and, again, boots on the ground people who are going to be out there doing the day-to-day actual enhancement work. So again, with the prairie side, pretty much all that money is going to go to contracts, supplies, which will be, again, more money into local small businesses in the rural part of the state, and a very small percentage of that would go towards DNR staffing. But again, you know, the boots on the ground, people getting stuff done. And then in Ricky's proposals, it's fewer larger projects, as well as the small wetlands and the shallow lakes program.
Jamie, is that enough of an answer for you, or do you want follow-up?
Nope, that's great. Thanks, Greg. Thanks, David.
All right. Other questions? So I think the question in front of us is, does someone want to make a motion to allocate off the top the $4.5 million of the request for roving crews alone, along with the expectation that accomplishment plans or language in our bill would free up the existing funds to allow for more flexibility or not? And that's the question. David, you have your hand up.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that if we start this on this project, we go down a slippery slope for all the rest of the projects that might be very, they might think that it's a really good project and we should allocate 100%. And next thing you know, we're voting on all these things and there's no money left for all the rest from. I think this just stays in the queue like all the rest do. I don't think it's a good idea to start voting on allocations now until we see all of the projects.
Okay, thank you. Other thoughts? Yes, Ron?
Well, I think it's a good idea to allow the roving crews flexibility. I'm not sure if that's what Senator Tomassoni was talking about. Because otherwise, if we don't do that, then one roving crew can't go work on another project because it's not under the description of the other project. So this makes sense to, this is like saying you have to allow a fish manager to raise fish and also stock them. The way we have it right now, this roving crew can only work on wetlands. They can't set a prairie fire. So I think if I understand it, that's what we're trying to solve. I don't quite understand, however, putting some money ahead, like they're afraid the legislature won't approve the bill or whatever. We've always kind of focused on the fact that we don't want habitat money to just be sitting there for a year. It should be on the ground. So I have a concern about that. Maybe you can explain that, David.
Which David?
I think he was talking to me, unfortunately.
And Mr. Chairman, I wasn't talking about any flexibility. I was only talking about allocating all the money in a vote on the first project. Okay.
And Dan has a question, but I think the issue which Mark tried to cover is by having 1 year ahead. If for some reason we didn't have a bill or that was passed, the roving crew would not stop on July 1st of the following year. Most of the projects that we're funding are 2 or 3 year funding requests, and this would essentially put you on a schedule of being 1 year ahead. They have the money for the next fiscal year already, so they're looking in their request for fiscal 23. They said that in 20, then next year they would go for $9 million, which would be 2 years ahead. I personally would think if we're getting into this cycle, we would only fund 1 year ahead so that there's never a work stoppage on these projects. And I think that's what they were envisioning. But Dan, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a big supporter, obviously, of the roving crews, and I want to give them some of that flexibility that they're talking about. I'm not sure how we bring all this together. I do, too, have some concerns about funding out into the future, but I think that this is one of those issues, as Member McNamara was talking about earlier, that's been something that I've really believed in, and that and the CPL, and I just want to make sure that we get the money to the roving crews so that they can do their work in a flexible way, and I'm looking for some guidance in this to how we can do that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Denny?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And where I think this is a real strong one, it would be fine if we put it ahead of everybody else. I think Senator Tomasoni made a pretty moving point that if this is that great of a proposal after we listen to everybody else, it should stand alone. I actually think it's kind of non-controversial, the flexibility part of their proposal. So I think that we probably will be able to agree on that. And when we get to the end, we can have a discussion about after hearing everybody. But I think Senator Tomasoni made a good point. To the point about why we're doing it a year ahead, this one's kind of unique. These are regular DNR employees that come July 1st, if the legislature didn't pass a bill for Lessard Sams, it would put all those employees in immediate limbo, whereas other ones might be subjected to a government shutdown and have access to other funding. Without a Lessard Sams bill, there's a strong reason to do this 1 year in advance. So I would hope that we continue to do that because it would really make challenges in the budget. And remember, Commissioner Holson, when he was a different commissioner, would know all too well, those would be really serious challenges and it would put a lot of pressure on the Lessard Sams bill. But I can see where Senator Tomasoni's coming from. And I would agree with him that we can wait till the end.
So the question, if we wait till the end, and I'm comfortable with doing whatever the group wants to do, is we have to figure out how we handle the allocation amounts because we have both these two proposals with and without a roving crew and a roving crew proposal. So if in the end the allocation amounts you want allocated, we would have to figure out a strategy for the allocations in this case. And maybe we can have this discussion on Thursday afternoon and figure out if we want to do something specific to the roving crews to give everyone some direction as to how to do the ultimate allocation. That's really the challenge. Dan, you still have your hand up. Are you waiting?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'll put it down. Thank you.
Okay. Tom.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I agree with Senator Tomasoni. As much as I agree with probably fully funding roving crews at the end as well as this, what Danny McNamara said about the about our small grants program, I don't think we ought to start dedicating funds yet. You know, I think we ought to wait till the end. Thank you.
Great. Does anyone feel differently? Mark? There you go.
Yeah, no, I don't mind holding off on the allocation. I think that's appropriate. I just I think the track that I think I've heard everyone want to go with and I would support is that you fund the roving crews, and Denny's right. The complication of how the system process works in the legislature and funding and how it actually works inside the agency. For these people specific, having that carry forward dollars available so that they know they're there makes a lot of sense if we really are serious about having these roving crews. Ultimately, I think these roving crews need to come out of this system and become part of the normal DNR budget process because it's clearly that good and what we want to see and what they want to see, but that's a different issue for a different time. But for today, the roving crews run as a separate funding stream because as I understood it, the other two proposals can operate with, I'm sorry, we don't have to do those two. And the roving crews can still move forward and do the work on the land, where we can fully fund the roving crews and then allocate a different dollar amount to those other two proposals, and they can rise and fall independently, if that makes sense.
Sure. Mark?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just to clarify here for everybody, we have heard the roving crew presentation, and we heard PRE01B, like in Baker, and WRE01B, that are prairie and wetland restoration enhancement programs without roving crews. At the last council meeting, the council had asked that we only hear those three and we not hear PRE01A or WRE01A, simply because we'd be looking at roving crews independently. So if the on Thursday the council decides that we want to also hear PRE01A and the two A projects, we can bring them back. But the other thing would be that if the council decides that roving crews are not going to be a separately funded program, then we could just presume that those figures are then wrapped into the PRE01A and WRE01A. So we'd look at the funding amounts for the A projects instead of the B projects. I hope that's clear enough. I hope I didn't mess it up or muck it up more.
Yeah, well, I think hearing the council, we will figure out a proposed recommendation for how we handle this to be discussed on Thursday afternoon after we've heard all the rest of the proposals. And unless someone objects, we'll move on to the next presentation. Is there anyone who wants a final word? All right. So let's move on to proposal PA01, DNR, WMA, and SNA acquisition. Jay Johnson. I see Jay coming online. Unmute yourself, Jay. There you go. Thank you very much. Thanks for putting on a tie from your home office. Please go ahead.
Chairman Hartwell. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now.
Very good. Chairman Hartwell, members, thank you.
There you go.
Chairman Hartwell, members, thank you for the opportunity to present. We are honored to be here. My name is Jay Johnson. I'm the WMA acquisition coordinator. I'm getting some
let me suggest that you hang up and come back in. We will move to the next presentation and then come back to you, if that's all right, Jay.
Hey, Mr. Chair, it's McNamara. If he turns his video off, he might be okay.
Do you want to try that, Jay?
I will try stopping my video.
All right, you have feedback now.
So how is this? Is this better?
Yep, it's just fine.
Okay. Chairman Hartwell, members, thank you for the opportunity to present. We're honored to be here. My name is Jay Johnson. I'm the WMA Acquisition Coordinator for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And in the Zoom waiting room, is Molly Roski. She's the SNA program supervisor with the Division of Ecological Water Resources. We are here today seeking your support for the Minnesota DNR WMA-SNA acquisition proposal. This is phase 13 of this ongoing and successful program. We're here today asking you to fund another phase of this program because our work clearly fits the constitutional intent of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which is to protect, restore, enhance prairies, wetlands, forests, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And we've been successful in being able to utilize our past Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations and achieve or exceed our accomplishment plan goals. And we target for acquisition some of the most threatened habitats in the state. These include grassland wetland habitat complexes, remnant native prairie, and sites of biodiversity significance. In addition, the majority of our acquisitions are in counties with very little public land. Since we submitted our proposal this past May, we've continued to build on this legacy of success. This fall, we have a closing scheduled for the final parcel on our ML 17 appropriation. And when that acquisition closes, we will have exceeded our accomplishment plan goal for acres protected. We've closed on one project, have a binding agreement on a second, and have two verbal agreements for parcels we plan to purchase with our ML 18 appropriation. And that will take care of all of our acquisition related work there. We have made an offer and are in negotiations with landowner for a 265-acre addition to a WMA in Lincoln County, which we'll fund with our ML-19 parcel list. And we have a verbal agreement for the first project on our ML-20 parcel list. To accomplish the work outlined in our proposal, we are seeking $4.5 million to acquire 750 acres of WMA and SNAs in the LSOHC Northern Forest, Forest Prairie, and Prairie Planting section. To achieve this, we'll identify and pursue high priority parcels. And in the case of WMAs, what that means is we prioritize and rank parcels in our twice a year regional ranking exercise. And then we run them through our strategic wildlife and aquatic acquisition tool, which is what we call our SWOT tool, and establish a SWOT score. And we make sure that the parcels satisfy three or more of our SLAM, that's strategic land asset management goals, and that they support the goals of our Conservation That Works 3.0 WMA AMA strategic plan for acquisition, which also draws on the prairie plan, the pheasant plan, so on and so forth. In the case of SNAs, we prioritize parcels located in conservation opportunity areas identified within the SNA strategic land protection plan and that satisfy three or more SLAM goals. And we also prioritize sites of high or outstanding biodiversity significance or that have high quality native plant communities. And then finally, all SNAs are a ecological evaluation is conducted by staff from the Minnesota Biological Survey prior to proceeding with the acquisition. We work with willing sellers. We seek county board approval before completing each WMA or SNA acquisition. And we calculate and pay PILT to counties on all SNA and WMA acquisitions. In conclusion, by fully funding our proposal and becoming our partner in conservation, you'll help us protect grassland wetland habitat complexes, remnant native prairie, and areas of biodiversity significance. And I apologize for that little glitch in the technology and getting started, but that with that, Molly and I are available to answer any questions about our proposal.
Great, thank you very much, Jay. Members, questions? Mark?
Yeah, Jay, Mark Olson. Help me understand. We have a number of different proposals coming through here. We have the accelerated wildlife management through PF. We've got Ducks Unlimited doing we have a couple different ones coming in that are targeted more different regions of the state. You're kind of spread around the state. How is your proposal different from theirs? I mean, what's different about these lands that you're targeting that they're not?
Chairman Hartwell, Member Holston, I would say that in some ways our proposals are somewhat similar, except you have to realize that ours is a combined WMA-SNA proposal. So the SNA program is targeting sites that would not necessarily be typically targeted by a partner who is acquiring on our behalf and gifting to the state a WMA. When you're looking at the WMA component of our proposal, I would say that there is a more of an overlap with some of what the partners are doing in terms of the parcels they're acquiring also. And so what we do is that twice a year we hold a meeting where we bring the partners together. Recently, we've had to do this virtually because of COVID-19, but we would normally sit down in a conference room, look at all available parcels at the time that we're putting our proposals together, try to look at and see, knowing full well that certain partners have certain specific things that they are targeting for acquisition. We kind of pass those highly ranked parcels out to the partner whose proposal best fits the parcel. But in some cases, in particular, like I would say with us and maybe Pheasants Forever or say Fox Lake Conservation League, the actual habitat types that we're targeting to acquire are often pretty similar, either grassland or grassland wetland habitat complexes.
Other, Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jay, I'm just curious, down the line here on the proposals, we have a Martin County Wildlife Management Area acquisition. Why isn't DNR involved in that, or are you, or why is that a separate one and not part of your proposal?
Yeah, Jay, you're on mute. You're still on mute.
We're Chairman Hartwell, Member Shera. We are involved in the sense that we work with Fox Lake Conservation League, Doug Hartke, to identify parcels that are in Martin County where they very specifically acquire. But since they're so active in that county, we don't typically target parcels there. So I'm not exactly sure I fully understood your question, but that's sort of the cooperative nature that we work with Fox Lake Conservation League.
Ron, did that answer your question?
Well, yes and no, because my understanding was early on, DNR was opposed to what Martin County was trying to do. You had nothing to do with it there. I'm just trying to figure out if that's true or what the heck's going on. Is you have you asking for money and they're asking for $9 million. You're asking for $4 million. It's a little confusing from where I sit.
Member
Jamie, do you have Jay, go ahead.
Yeah, Member Hartwell, Chair Hartwell, Member Shera, I don't have a long enough history with the program to know if that is the case, but there's nothing in my time with the program that would indicate that we would, you know, there was any kind of like, we would have nothing to do with working with Fox Lake Conservation League or in Martin County. So I really can't speak to that.
Jamie, go ahead.
Thanks, David. Two questions. The first one, the appropriation amount has gone up, but it looks like the total acres have been lower in the last 3 years compared to previous. And so I wanted to give you a chance to speak to that. And then also, why is there no leverage in this proposal compared to previous years?
Jay?
Chairman Hartwell, members, I'm not exactly sure, but if it's a question about the total, our total acres in the ask versus the amount asked for, it's been relatively similar year to year for the past few years. So I'm not exactly certain about that. I mean, we look at what's available for parcels at the point in time when we put our proposal together. We have a certain sort of dollar figure in mind on what average cost of a parcel might be based on past experience, and also looking at, you know, University of Minnesota extension costs for farmland as it relates to WMAs. So, you know, I'm not certain that there was any particular reason why that was noticed, Member Swenson. But as far as the leverage, we don't ever list a leverage amount in our proposal. As a state agency, we can't make a promise without having an encumbrance of funding available. So the way that leverage works for us is that when we're working with acquisition with a landowner, we seek a donation of land value, which we can then use as leverage. But we don't know that at the point in time when we submit our proposal. So historically, we've never put a leverage amount. We've suggested that, you know, historically, here's what our leverage has been. And, you know, we strive for trying to achieve leverage over the length of our appropriation. But, you know, at the time of a proposal is submitted, I can't really make any promises about that.
Jamie, did you have a follow-up question?
Yep. Thank you, Jane. And my first question was related to the second to last page of the proposal showing the goal versus the acquired optioned acres compared to the appropriation funding and leverage graph. And so that's where that was my source of information for that question. And so I appreciate the follow-up and the answers to both questions. Thank you.
Great. Are there any other questions? All right, Jay, thank you very much. Appreciate you hanging in there with your technology issues. Next, we'll move on to PA02, Accelerating the Wildlife Management Area Program, from Sabin Adams. Here we go. Sabin, are you there? We can't see or hear you. Sabin, unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right. Let's see if I can avoid the technology issues here. Well, I don't think you're going to be able to see me, unfortunately.
That's all right. We'll imagine something.
Okay. All right. Well, good morning, morning, Mr. Chair, council members, and staff. My name is Sabin Adams. I'm the Minnesota Project Manager with Pheasants Forever. Joining me today is Fred Bankson, the Area Wildlife Manager with Minnesota DNR out of the Sauk Rapids office. We are presenting on the Accelerating the Wildlife Management Area Program, Phase 13. This phase of the program is requesting $13,876,100 and bringing $2.9 million of non-state match. With these funds, we intend to protect and restore 2,330 acres in the prairie, forest prairie, and metro regions. By permanently protecting and restoring prairie and wetland habitats for wildlife as WMAs, this proposal directly addresses goals of numerous conservation plans referenced by this council, including the Minnesota Conservation and Preservation Plan, the Minnesota Pheasant and Duck Action Plans, and the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan, among others. If I could draw your attention to the first page of the handout that we provided. As you can see, we've been very successful with previous phases of this proposal, over-delivering on acres and match. And I have a couple notes to share. Phases 1 through 5 have all been completed. Final reports have been submitted and approved. Phase 6 and 7 have the final reports. We're drafting them currently. Phase 8 and 9, all of the acquisitions are complete and the remaining balance is used primarily for restorations. Phase 10, we have 5 additional projects that are at the purchase agreement stage. And in phase 11, we have 7 projects with verbal agreements to sell and 2 projects from which we have ordered appraisals and are currently working on. So as you can see, we've been very successful and are currently working on moving all of these along. And so with that, I'd like to hand it over to Fred, who's going to talk about a recent acquisition project of ours. Are you on, Fred?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, council members, and staff. As Saban said, my name is Fred Banks, and I am the Minnesota DNR Wildlife Manager for the St. Cloud area that includes Stearns, Wright, and Sherburne counties. My staff and I manage 64 WMAs totaling 14,000 acres in those 3 counties. I want to take this time to extend my appreciation for the council's past support and funding for WMA and WPA acquisition via our conservation partners groups and the natural resource agencies. Partnerships and collaboration are the cornerstone components to achieving great land and water conservation outcomes. It is no secret that Pheasants Forever is one of our leaders in this effort. Minnesota Pheasants Forever volunteers and staff are top notch, and I have enjoyed working with PF chapters and staff for over 35 years. Through this time, PF chapters have been responsible for adding over 40 new WMAs in my work area alone. That's simply outstanding. The New Frenzel WMA is another wonderful example of this, conserving 240 acres of prairie and wetland habitat near the Kimball area forever and providing an awesome place for families and kids to enjoy the outdoors. And it's only 45 minutes from the Twin Cities. Simply wonderful. Public acceptance and support of WMA and WPA acquisition is critical. I am fortunate to have good relationships with my county and township governments. I place a high priority on this, as does our leadership. I consider WMA and WPA land acquisition the most important conservation work we do for wildlife. Again, I want to thank you for your opportunity to lend my support for Minnesota Pheasant Forever's Phase 13, Accelerating the Wildlife Management Area Program Outdoor Heritage Fund proposal. Thank you.
Great, thank you very much for your question. Any questions from council members? All right, I guess your presentation answered our questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time this morning. So we will move on to PA03. Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project, Neil Feakin from the Nature Conservancy. Neil, you're on mute. There you go. Go ahead, Neil.
Morning, Mr. Chair. It's a little hard for me to believe that a year has slipped by us already, but here we are again. My name is Neil Feakin. I am the Prairie Recovery Program Director and Grassland Conservation Program Director for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota, and I am here today to talk to you a little bit about Prairie Recovery Program Phase 11. I think everybody on this call has heard this presentation several times, so I'm going to try and highlight the top level stories and talk a little bit more in depth about how we try to leverage this work beyond just LSOHC funding. So as you saw in our proposal, we are seeking about $6.5 million, and the money is going for protection, enhancement, and restoration across prairie core and corridor areas as identified in the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan. Our protection work focuses on about trying to do 800 acres of fee title that will be owned and managed by the Nature Conservancy. And consistent with previous proposals, all lands that are acquired by the Conservancy using these funds and held by TNC, we will continue to pay property taxes on those, and consistent with the constitutional requirements, all of the lands acquired with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars are open to public use, including hunting, fishing, collecting, photography, hiking, et cetera, et cetera. With respect to enhancement, we anticipate accomplishing about 20,000 acres on permanently protected lands, including state assets like wildlife management areas and SNAs, prairie bank easements, and federal lands, particularly WPAs and national wildlife refuges. Our enhancement techniques include prescribed fire, woody control, invasive removal, and seeding degraded grassland systems. And then finally, we do a limited amount of restorations, which is in our definition is kind of starting over. Like if you need to go down to bare dirt or you're starting with the farm field, we anticipate accomplishing about 500 acres of prairie restoration with highly diverse locally collected native seeds. What we've done to date, we're very proud and satisfied with the work that we've accomplished in partnership with the council and with our partners, both state and federal. We have protected nearly 8,000 acres, most of which is near TNC preserves, and most of which is in prairie core areas. We've enhanced over 150,000 acres with prairie recovery dollars through the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And we're really, really pleased with the efficiencies that we're able to capture with that. Our average cost per acre for enhancement work is about $100 per acre. And then finally, we've restored about 1,500 acres using legacy dollars. As I mentioned at the beginning, I want to spend a couple minutes talking about how we really try hard to leverage your investment beyond just that core work that I just described. In past years, I've brought field staff, field biologists in to describe some of those leveraging efforts. And you might recall, I had Travis Isendorf in a couple of years ago talking about how the Conservancy has convened and coordinated the collaborative seed harvest efforts in Northwest Minnesota and Central Minnesota. Greg Hoke alluded to that this morning when he talked about collecting highly diverse seed and using that on partner lands. It generates several hundred thousand dollars of value in rare and hard to collect seed every year that's used by a wide consortium of conservation partners to achieve restoration and enhancement on permanent protected lands. We've talked about our prescribed fire initiatives and how we've really worked hard, particularly in the Northwest, to ramp up the scale of those fires using some different techniques and partnering and collaborating and convening those partnerships, going from several hundred acre burns to several thousand acre burns, been a highly effective conservation tool. And what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today is our efforts in Big Stone, Lac La Parle, and Yellow Medicine County, focused on Siberian elm removal. I was hoping to bring our field biologist in the Morris Station in to talk with me or to talk with you this morning, just because of time we elected not to do that. But she's working on some really, really important and impressive projects in those three counties. Many of you probably already know that Siberian elm is one of the primary threats that we have to open prairies, particularly on the western border counties with South Dakota and North Dakota. It's particularly pervasive and fast growing and fast spreading. So we have spent a fair amount of effort over the last couple of years removing that from the Chippewa Prairie, Big Stone National Wildlife Refuge, and various WPAs and WMAs across the region. We use mechanical techniques. We'll hire contractors to go in and cut large trees out. We hire either CCM or seasonal staff to hand remove resprouts and seedlings. And we use prescribed fire as a way to keep those trees at bay. One thing we have found, though, is that even after we remove them, there's a large population of seed source trees surrounding a lot of these conservation lands. So we have started an outreach effort to work with our local neighbors to start educating them about the threat of Siberian elm and talking to them about the potential to eliminate that, which will help eliminate the seed source for ongoing conservation lands.
Neil, you're running out of time.
All right, one more minute, David. Interestingly, cemeteries, abandoned cemeteries is one of the leading sources of seed. And those are really hard to manage because it's hard to find people that are responsible for those. And when you do, it's cost prohibitive. So we're working on finding solutions for that. With that, I will yield for questions. And once again, thank you for your consideration.
All right, any questions? Last call for questions for Neil. Neil, I think you answered our questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time this morning. All right, next on our list is PA 04, Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. Ruth, are you there? Ruth is coming in. You have to unmute yourself, Ruth.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can. Thank you very much for your time this morning. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. Chairman Hartwell and members of the council, I appreciate the opportunity to present a proposal this morning. I'm Ruth Thornton with the Nature Conservancy, and I'm the program manager for the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Acquisition Program for TNC. I'm joined today by Scott Simmons from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Scott is a coordinator of the Northern Tallgrass Prairie Refuge. As some of you may be aware, this refuge is located in western Minnesota and Iowa and was established in 2000 to permanently protect native tallgrass prairie, of which less than 1% remains in Minnesota. To date, the refuge has protected more than 12,000 acres, and funding from the Outdoor Heritage Fund alone has protected 6,400 of those acres, more than half, and has been instrumental to the success of the refuge so far. The focus of the program is both fee and easement acquisitions of high-quality native prairie. We have found that this is a good mix of providing recreational opportunities, such as hunting and fishing for the general public, while also keeping some of the land in production as privately owned haying or grazing lands, which helps support the local community. When deciding on which properties to include in the program, we consider a number of different factors, including how much native prairie is left on the property, and if it is located in a priority area identified in the Prairie Conservation Plan. Another major factor is the connectivity of the parcel with existing protected lands, and if the Minnesota Biological Survey has identified any populations of threatened, endangered, or rare species or vegetative communities on the property. We use these and other factors to vet each and every parcel to ensure that only the highest quality lands that will significantly contribute to prairie conservation will be included in the refuge. This is the 12th time that we are requesting funding for this program. And I would like to give you a brief summary of our accomplishments so far. To date, we've completed all acquisitions through the Minnesota Laws 2016 funding cycle, and we're almost done with the ML17 funding cycle. Of the more than 6,400 acres protected, 59% are native remnant prairie, 87% are in prairie plan priority areas, and 49% of acres have significant biodiversity as mapped by the Minnesota Biological Survey. In the last year alone, we have added 4,300 feet of designated critical habitat for the endangered Topeka shiner and protected a federally threatened plant, in addition to numerous rare animals and plants. And all of this has been achieved at an average person's purchase price of just over $2,000 per acre. We are currently in active negotiations with landowners on several properties. If all of these negotiations are successful, they would spend down the ML 17 and 18 phases fully, and more landowners have expressed interest in working with us. As you can see, so far we have achieved significant conservation of native prairie and associated wildlife with this program. That is why we are asking you now for your support of our current proposal, Phase 12. If you were to approve funding for our proposal, it would enable the protection of an additional 2,300 acres, including more than 1,230 acres of native remnant prairie. I have just given you an update on the progress and accomplishments of prior funding rounds, and now Scott wanted to share a more personal view on what success of the program looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, council members. I must say we sit here today in a very different scenario, and that's really unexpected regardless of how any of us feel on the subject of COVID. But knowing this, I want to share with you something that has become so evident in the last 6 months, and that is that nature and the outdoors continue steadfast. I mean, that's really the one thing that didn't change when COVID or chaos brought restrictions. It's also the very thing this council, this program, and many others presenting are working towards. I also want you to know I've been tasked to lead a team within our agency that recognizes the value of our employees' well-being, whether that's physical, emotional, mental. So many of the things we've identified revolve around the outdoors, nature, and the need to just take a break from all of it. This state, this presentation right now, and all of you are doing the very same thing for the citizens of Minnesota and those that visit the state. We're providing folks a place and opportunity to take the break and ultimately keeping them resilient and healthy while at the same time protecting some of the state and nation's rarest plant and animal communities. That is a win-win no matter how you package it. You know, one thing I was allowed to do early on from a work standpoint when things changed was drive around and look at the land this program manages. And I don't get to do that very often, but I was blown away in a different capacity. People needed the land. It's almost as if that's all they had at times. There were people, families, kids interacting out on the prairie, out in the wild, that I wouldn't see till maybe hunting season. And I'm not sure I still would have seen that many people. And what really a healing power that is, that your past and hopefully present decisions continue to support. As I drove around, I saw these kids. They were removed from school. They were throwing rocks out on the prairie. They were honestly breaking branches. They were damaging vegetation. And for the first time, I probably really didn't care. Honestly, in my own mind, I was thinking, you know what? Do whatever you want. You're out here, you're getting by the best way you know how, and you found these cool resources that everyone is wanting to protect for the future. So, you know, really COVID or chaos beyond my personal values showed me that what we are doing is so much greater for reasons we were never predicting. And that really, in addition with everything in the past over the years I've talked to you guys about, is why I hope you really continue to support the program. So thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions.
Great. Council members, any questions? Last chance on questions. All right, Ruth and Scott, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Next up, we have Christy Purcell with Cannon River Partnership Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration Program, PA05. Christy, yeah, there you go.
Howdy.
Go ahead, please.
Again, thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
for inviting me to present today. I'm honored to have the opportunity to tell you about Cannon River Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration Program Phase 10. So I'm Christy Purcell, Executive Director of Cannon River Watershed Partnership here in Northfield. Joining me on the call and perhaps to answer questions is DJ Forbes, Project Manager, Trust for Public Land, as well as Brad Gordon, the Southern Minnesota Program Manager from Great River Greening. So we've requested $5,137,900 for our proposal, and $4.3 million of that, 84%, is budgeted for land acquisition and restoration activities. So about 350,000 acres of our 946,000-acre watershed were once wetland. Today, more than 80% of the land in the Cannon River watershed has been developed, and what remains of the watershed's prairies, big woods, and wetland biomes totals only about 170,000 acres. And due to invasive species and residential, industrial, and agricultural development, many of these important habitats are now impaired or degraded. For example, the 2016 Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategies Report found that all but a few of the water bodies in the Cannon River watershed are impaired. However, actions have been taken to turn around the loss of these habitats. Since 2010, the Outdoor Heritage Fund has supported land protection in the Cannon River watershed, permanently protecting land that is the only place in Minnesota and the world where a very small flowering plant, the dwarf trout lily, grows. Our request to fund phase 10 of this habitat protection and restoration work will permanently protect approximately 640 new acres and restore or enhance approximately 350 new acres. In phase 10, we'll utilize the strengths of each of our three organizations to continue outreach to local landowners and provide expertise in land acquisition and habitat restoration. We'll continue to work with the DNR to restore and enhance wildlife management areas that were previously protected using scientifically sound habitat management methods. These important habitats will become healthy ecological systems into the future. We have a proven track record, as you have seen on our handout already. We've created 7 new wildlife management areas and considerably expanded 5 more WMAs. We have permanently protected over 2,400 acres in the Cannon River watershed, and we have another 220 acres under option for 2 projects. I'm happy to report that we have not only accomplished but exceeded our goals from previous rounds of funding from the council, and the money that was just appropriated to this project has already been committed. Restoration activities conducted by Great River Greening began as part of phase 8 of this partnership, and work on 5 WMAs and 1 regional park is currently underway. These permanently protected and restored natural systems lead to improved plant communities and wildlife habitat, more outdoor access, and better water quality. These spaces are now available to everyone, providing new public access within 1 hour's drive for nearly 3 million people, over half of all Minnesotans. And in this moment, as we heard from the previous presenters, access to outdoor space is more important to the public than ever. Now is the time. There are more people interested in protecting their lands than there is currently funding available. The longer we wait to restore or enhance many of these sites, the more expensive they will be later as invasive species continue to outpace our natives. In closing, we are the only partnership working to preserve and enhance the lands and natural areas in the Cannon River watershed. And we know that degradation and loss of habitat can have significant negative impacts on public investment, especially on infrastructure, and diminish outdoor experiences. The Cannon River Watershed Habitat Protection and Restoration Program Phase 10 delivers a means to turn around habitat loss and degradation and create new and better opportunities for hunting, hiking, fishing, birding, photography, just to name a few of the many activities available for literally millions of Minnesotans in the Cannon River watershed. Thank you.
Great. Are there questions? Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Purcell, you talked about access, and it brings up an issue that's important to me. What have you done in the Cannon River watershed and so forth to enhance access for people who have severe mobility issues and require some sort of motorized transportation in order to be able to enjoy the outdoors like you and I can.
Thank you for asking that question. That's a really great question and really, really important to make sure that truly Minnesotans do have access. Because my organization works with the outreach with the communities, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure if one of my counterparts, DJ or Brad, can answer that, but if not, I'd be happy to get back to you because I agree wholeheartedly. Really, really important to make sure that people do truly have access. Maybe DJ, can you address that?
Thank you. I'd love to address that. Chair Hartwell, Member Fabian, the land protection work that we do is primarily with the Minnesota DNR Department of, or Division of Wildlife, excuse me. And so a lot of the wildlife management areas that we have helped create and expand are accessible, have limited accessibility in that there's not a high amount of trails and no paved trails throughout. And so it's a really great question and something that I think should be a larger conversation among NGOs and the DNR at large in terms of how are we ensuring that folks of all, you know, races, creeds, abilities are able to explore these outdoor experiences. So I'd happy to dig into that in the future and would love to hear some of your thoughts on it as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may continue.
Please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So DJ, I'd be very interested in having that conversation with you. I'd also ask you to, you know, we've got the allocation process ahead of us yet where we're gonna have to make recommendations. One of the things that, and this is going to be for all presenters, one of the things that I'm going to be very interested in is what conversations directly have they had with DNR? And if you've got any documents, any letters and so forth that you're writing, any conversations, I'd be very, very interested in seeing what steps you're taking to open up these areas to more access for people who have very, very, I'll just say they need more access for their motorized transportation. So that'll be something that's important to me in the process that's going forward. Thank you.
Great. Are there other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah? Oh, Mark. Sorry, Mark, I didn't see your hand. I was looking for a different hand. Go ahead.
Christy, this is more of a statement that I would like you to respond to than a question. In reading through this, this one really struck at, this proposal struck at me in that, in the conflict that I think the council either is going to be having in the future, or maybe some of us are all experiencing the same thing. But in this particular one, you highlight the volume of, or the speed in which the land in the watershed is being developed, both past and projected. Is this a, So as I'm looking at this, I'm like, okay, we should either be doubling down kind of in this area or maybe reevaluating, do we really want to move forward any further than we have today based upon community planning, what is all going on in that particular area? That gives us some reassurance as we look forward that our investments are going to be, I don't want to say taken advantage of because they're going to be, but how do I spend dollars here where I could be maximizing them someplace else for more value?
Sure. I will take a stab at, of course, my point of view as a resident of the watershed and down this way. I think our watershed covers basically six majority counties. One of them is Dakota County, which is, I think, the fastest growing as far as population and development of all the counties in the state. It is about 6%, just the very, very kind of top part of our watershed. When I participated with Rice County, which is a huge percentage of Rice County is in the watershed. With their strategic planning efforts, the thing that we heard from residents over and over and over was the rural nature of the county, really wanting to preserve both the rural nature and the agricultural nature of the watershed and just access to outdoors and spaces. So I do know, even though it varies depending on the governmental entity in charge of these different corners of the watershed, I do know that both Dakota County Parks, Rice County, Steele, all of these entities, they are really prioritizing this because that's part of the reason why people live here. And really that's why we're seeing a lot of people who come to visit here. It's close, the proximity to Rochester and the Twin Cities, but also it really feels quite removed. And when my friends come visit me from Minneapolis, they always say like, oh my gosh, it only took me 45 minutes to get here. And I always sort of say, shh. But it just feels really different and it's really accessible to people. So I, of course, my opinion is that that is really a value that I see shared, and that my not only neighbors and friends, but you know, government and decision makers are also really taking that into account as far as a quality of life being provided here. I hope that answers your question.
Great, thank you. Other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much, Christy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So members, we're 15 minutes ahead of schedule. Would you like to do the next proposal and then take a break, or just take a break now?
Do the next proposal.
Hearing nothing else, that's exactly what we're going to do. The next proposal is PA06, Accelerated Native Prairie Bank Protection. Judy with the DNR, Judy Schultz.
Good morning.
Good morning, Judy. Go ahead.
Thank you. As mentioned, my name is Judy Schulte, and I am the prairie biologist for the DNR Division of Ecological and Water Resources. My office, I'm based out of Redwood Falls. I'm technically coming to you from Bird Island, Minnesota today, where I live. As mentioned, I'm here to discuss Accelerated Native Prairie Bank Protection Phase 8, which aims to work with private landowners to permanently protect remnant never plowed native prairie within the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan priority areas. And as you all know, and I've probably heard in other proposals, native prairie is a fragile, unique ecosystem that consists of thousands of different organisms, plants, animals, bacteria, and soil fungi that work through complex interactions to provide the essentials required by Minnesota's rare, threatened, and endangered species. Though we try to mimic what time has done to create these prairies, it's hard to add 100 years of complex interactions to our restorations, no matter how well executed. So we see a lot of rare species that only remain on these high quality, never plowed prairies. Since only 1.3% of these remnant prairies remain, and they house more rare species than any other habitat type, it's essential that we ensure that these prairies are protected and as high functioning and diverse as possible. Since inception in 1987, Native Prairie Bank has been one of Minnesota's leading conservation easements for the protection of high quality remnant native prairie. As of right now, Native Prairie Bank protects 14,060 acres of some of Minnesota's best remaining remnant prairie, like the one behind me. Of the 14,060 acres protected in Native Prairie Bank's 34-year history, 94% are located within prairie plan priorities. That's 87% within core areas and 7% within corridors and habitat complexes. Prior to receiving OHF funding, Native Prairie Bank protected 7,874 acres over the course of 24 years, an average of 328 acres a year. Since receiving OHF funding and other grant dollars, Native Prairie Bank has protected 6,186 acres over the course of 10 years, an average of 619 acres per year. That's just about double the rate of protection. We protected almost as much in the last 10 years as we did the 24 years prior. Though we are small in quantity,
Judy, you're breaking up on us. Maybe you can turn off your video and that will help so we can hear you. Judy, we can't hear you. Judy, we're having a hard time hearing you. Can you turn off your video and maybe the voice will come through?
Sorry about that. I lost internet connection shortly. Can you guys hear me now?
We can hear you now. Thank you.
All right. We had a storm here last night and it's been messing with my internet all morning. All right. So, let's just pick up here. So I included a few photos of the prairies we've protected with previous OHF appropriations on the illustration I submitted with my proposal for your reference. It's roughly page 16. It's not really numbered, but if you want to look through that, if they're in the same order as what I pull offline. I often tell people my job is not to just find a needle in a haystack, but a pinhead in a haystack. There's not a lot of remnant prairie that meets the high standards in quality we aim for. We scour the state to find these unique fragments and essentially try to pull the puzzle pieces back together. I would be remiss if I did not mention the amazing landowners that we work with every day to protect and manage these prairies. It is the teamwork between our prairie specialists and landowners that makes Native Prairie Bank so successful in maintaining these prairies long-term. So through this proposal, we would aim to protect an additional 400 acres through permanent conservation easements, aiming for the best of the best prairie that Minnesota has left to offer. Eligible lands are scored and prioritized based on size, quality, and diversity of Native Prairie habitat, as well as occurrences of rare, threatened, and endangered species, species in greatest conservation need, and proximity to other conservation lands. If you take a look at the map I included with the proposal, the orange Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan core areas will be our main focus. However, we may also acquire within the corridor or habitat complexes. Between our scoring process and target areas, we are ensuring highly targeted strategic protection. So with that, I will thank you for your time and take any questions that you have.
Great, are there questions? Any questions? Judy, looks like you're off the hook. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I think we have time for one more before our break. We'll go to PA07, Rim Buffers for Wildlife and Water. Sharon. And Sharon, I'm going to not pronounce your last name because I know I will get it wrong, which I don't want to do. Just waiting for you to connect here. There, unmute yourself, Sharon. Great. Sharon, you can go ahead. Tell me how you pronounce your last name so I don't.
Last name is Doucette. Thank you, Chair Hartwell.
Thank you. Sorry I couldn't figure it out.
Nope, that's all right. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Hartwell. Chair Hartwell and members, Sharon Doucette. I am the easement section manager at Bowser, responsible for the Reinvest or RIM easement program. Just to highlight, the RIM program has had over 30 years of success with almost 8,000 easements now and over 326,000 acres recorded or in process currently. I'm here today to provide a summary of the RIM Buffers Phase 9 proposal. The proposal is for RIM easements for protection and restoration of expanded wildlife buffers. It is a $10 million request in the proposal for protection and restoration on 2,200 acres. The proposal leverages Clean Water Fund dollars for water quality and wildlife habitat. These easements provide protection, permanent protection on private lands, and the land stays on the tax roll. And it also builds permanent wildlife complexes. The program is delivered locally by soil and water conservation districts. The targeted sites are currently row crop agriculture or existing or expiring CRP. It's important to note that there are currently 330,000 acres of expiring CRP over the next 3 years between 2020 and 2022. Most recent phases of this buffer program that have been funded by the council, phases 5 through 8 were used as state match for CREP. This request is not funding specifically for CREP. Though all CREP funds have not been secured, there is an outstanding bonding request still. This proposal will return to a broader, more flexible state process, but with many of the same principles and the scoring criteria that we've been using for CREP. There is demand for non-CREP options and buffer funding outside of the CREP area. It is possible that if the enrollment cap in our agreement with the USDA for CREP is not yet met, some of these funds could possibly still be utilized as part of a CREP easement application. The program will fund buffers on waters not required to have a buffer under the buffer law, and also for expanded acreage on those requiring a buffer. As a reminder, the buffer law requires a 35-foot minimum and a 50-foot average buffer for public waters, and 16.5 feet for public ditches, and only covers 50% of the state's waters. The required buffer is the minimum recommended buffer for water quality. The buffer law also only requires perennial vegetation within the buffer. These buffer easements are split funded, with clean water funding used for water quality and the OHF funding used for expanded buffers to improve habitat through increased size and improved vegetation. For example, clean water fund could be used to expand the buffer outside of the required buffer area up to 100 feet, and then OHF funds could then be used to double that area to 200 feet. Protection of floodplains is also important as habitat for both terrestrial and aquatic species. This phase of the buffer program will continue with the traditional program eligibility and scoring, while also allowing enrollment for agricultural fields in the mapped floodplain of higher order streams and rivers. This could be up to 5,000 feet of floodplain in some cases. I felt it was important to point this out in the proposal and today, as this would be larger than what is normally thought of as a riparian buffer. The scoring and ranking process will allow selection of the sites that will be most impactful for wildlife habitat. Scoring criteria will consider if the water resource is included as a priority in an approved comprehensive water plan or is impaired, if the buffer area contains existing or expiring CRP acres, as well as site-specific criteria including the size of the buffer and the type of water resource being protected, as well as landscape scale criteria, including connectivity to existing permanent habitat. As this proposal for phase 9 of the buffer program, I wanted to also provide today a summary of previous phases' accomplishments. Phases 1 through 4 are now complete with final reports submitted. Those four phases were for a total of just over $10 million and protected and restored almost 3,000 acres. Demand has historically been high for previous rim buffer sign-up periods. For example, the sign-up in 2014 resulted in $37 million of applications, far outweighing the funding that we had for applications. This allows us to choose the best applications for permanent easement enrollment. Phases 5 through 8 of this program were used as a match, the state match for the CREP agreement. That was a total of $21.6 million, and over 7,000 acres in combination with Clean Water Fund have been secured currently. In our internal budgets, phases 5 and 6 are largely spent or encumbered, and phases 7 and 8 have significant spending with 2020 signups. Though our most recent status reports don't capture this information, as we're still in the early stages of processing many of this summer's applications that came in. Thank you, Chair Hartwell and members. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you very much. Questions? So I guess I had a question in hearing how you've spent the money, because, and you probably said it, but I didn't completely comprehend it. So let me put it to you this way. If we took a pause this year and didn't fund you, not because you're not a good program, but because you have funds that you're still working on spending from prior years, what would that do to you?
Certainly that would slow down our progress outside of the CREP area. As I mentioned, we have, the last several phases have been pretty specific to the 54 county CREP area. There is certainly pent up demand for us to have just a RIM only sign up as we had in years before CREP. I think we just will be putting people on hold for a few more years in those areas that have been patiently waiting for us to have a slightly more flexible state program and offer funding outside of the CREP area.
Dan, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's just to your point, the allocations that we've made in the past for to Bowser for the buffers in the CREP area and other areas, and money that's still there that's not spent, couldn't we make the same case for almost all the other proposers that are here, at least the big ones, the DNR, Pheasants Forever, Nature Conservancy, and those? They have funds that we've allocated to them that are still encumbered, I'll say.
Is that a question to me or to Sharon?
Well, that would just be somewhat of a rhetorical question to the group, Mr. Chair, and maybe it would be good for staff to put together some sort of a spreadsheet of the funds that are still existing. And, you know, we heard from one of the previous testifiers that they, or presenters, that they still had, I believe, money available from 2016. Just a point of interest. Thank you.
Okay. Sandy, can I call on you, because I know you track this really closely. Do you have any comments or insight you could provide on a generic basis, not specific to this proposal?
Yeah, so status updates, the deadline was a couple of weeks ago, so I'm still going through the stack and reading them, and I will put together a summary of kind of money spent to date and progress to date for everybody here. I guess I could probably get it done before allocations.
Is that before we allocate or before we have the discussion on allocations?
What would you prefer?
I think the sooner the better would be helpful as we go through the allocation process ourselves.
Yeah, that's fine. I can pull it together.
Okay. Great, thank you. Other questions for Sharon? Sorry, we're off track, Sharon. Seeing no other questions, thank you. Appreciate you joining us this morning, Sharon. Members, we'll take a 15-minute break. You can put your screen on stop video, which will keep you from having to call back in. Or you can call back in, kind of your choice. But we'll start at 10:45, back up. back into order. Next on our list is EA08, Prairie Chicken Habitat Partnership of the Southern Red River Valley. Sabin's back with us. Sabin, are you? Sabin, we see your ceiling. Are you with us, Sabin? Sabin, you're muted.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you. Your video is definitely right.
Yeah, I can't get it to switch to the right camera, so.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Doug, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Good morning. This is Doug Wells speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society. Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, council members, and staff. We're going to kick off the presentation here for a few minutes this morning about the Prairie Chicken Habitat Partnership of the Southern Red River Valley, Phase 7. You've got the numbers in front of you, a little under $10 million requested. So I've got just a few key points that I'd like to make, and then I'll let Sabin take over. First of all, a little background on the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society. It's a volunteer organization that's been in existence for over 45 years. And they have about five different points of focus that they'd like to put their energies into, one of which is habitat protection. And that's one of the reasons why we're here today. And the reason the prairie chicken is so important, first of all, it's a very charismatic species because of the breeding activity that takes place on the leks in the springtime. And if anybody has not seen that, I would suggest you put that on your bucket list. Sort of captures people's imagination and their will and makes it a very sort of charismatic species. But there's, beyond that, there's a more equally important reason, I should say, to focus on the prairie chicken. And that's because it's an umbrella species. You could call it an ambassador for grassland birds and grassland wildlife in general, in the fact that it requires large tracts of grassland on the landscape in order to thrive. And that's one of the challenges today, particularly given the lack of CRP and the decline in CRP. And prairie chicken numbers track extremely well with the amount of grassland, specifically if you look at CRP acres on the landscape, those prairie chicken numbers track extremely well with CRP acres. So what we're trying to focus on here is to create large blocks of grassland in a fairly contiguous area that form a nucleus for prairie chickens to continue to thrive and expand outward as perhaps other federal farm programs kick in. So this is a very much a partnership program, of course, with Pheasants Forever, who does a lot of the behind the scenes work on behalf of the Prairie Chicken Society and to administer the grant. But it's a big partnership with the Minnesota DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who take over the ownership and the maintenance of any tracks that we acquire through grant monies that we received in the past. I think it's important to note that our approach in acquiring lands and going after parcels of land has been what I think has been very strategic. It's been focused on areas that either historically or currently have had prairie chicken populations and would add to an existing habitat base. So we're not trying to go out into the middle of a largely agricultural landscape and create something new. We're trying to add on to what's already there. That provides a lot of additional viewing and hunting opportunity as well. So as an example of one of the recent acquisitions, the Prosby WMA in Norman County was 960 acres. Just an example of the kind of work that goes on. There's 40 wetlands that will or have been restored on the property, including over 1 mile of ditches that have been filled in. It's 480 acres of marginal cropland that will be seeded either this fall or the fall of 21 as seed sources become available. Property was transferred to the DNR in July, and it'll be open for public hunting this fall. And wildlife managers reported his last trip out there, he saw like 25 prairie chickens out there. We see this time and time again as we buy these properties, restore the habitat out there.
if the chickens weren't already there, they show up. And if the chickens are there, relating to what I mentioned earlier, then there's a good chance we're maybe going to see marbled godwit out there, or upland sandpipers, or a whole host of other grassland prairie-related species. So those are the main points that I wanted to make this morning. And at this point, I think I'll turn it over to Sabin.
Thank you, Doug. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Council members. Pheasants Forever has been working with the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society since the beginning of this program to make it very successful. As you can see by the front page of the handout we provided, we've been able to over-deliver our acres and our match every year. I have a few notes to go over. On phase one of this program, we've submitted the final report and it has been approved. Phases two and three, all of the acquisitions are complete and the remaining balance is being used for restoration. Phase four, we have two verbal agreements from landowners to sell. And on phase five, all of the acquisitions are complete and we are working on restoration. And that's my little catch up. So with that, I thank you for your time and we will take any questions.
Great questions. Any questions from members? I guess not. Thank you very much, both of you, for being with us this morning. We appreciate your work. Next is PA09, Accelerating the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Habitat Conservation Easement Program. John, are you?
Mr. Chair, members, we're missing John Schneider yet, and we are a little bit ahead of schedule. So, but we do have everyone for the following presentation, if you want to push that one first.
All right. We'll go to PA 10, Martin County WMA Acquisition. Doug, are you with us? I can see Doug's connecting. Doug, it looks like you're with us. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Hartwell and council members. It is a great day to be here to testify on behalf of PA10 Martin County DNR WMA Acquisition Phase 5. I am Doug Hartke, Grant Coordinator for the Fox Lake Conservation League of Sherburn, Minnesota. Our local club has chosen to work with the Conservation Fund to assist us with all real estate portions of land acquisitions, and Ducks Unlimited to help us with wetland and grassland restorations. Here with me today is Emily Nelson of the Conservation Fund and John Lindstrom, a regional biologist with Ducks Unlimited. Our partnership was put together to work with the Minnesota DNR and add important WMA additions to the existing habitat complexes in Martin County. A map was included in your additional packets, PA10 map, that shows the parcels that we are trying to acquire to add to the existing WMA systems in Martin County. Currently, the DNR owns less than 2% of land base in Martin County. The Fox Lake Conservation works within the DNR to proactively determine the most ideal additions and roundouts to the current habitat complexes. We are a local grassroots organization and know our local landowners and our county's habitat very well. We will have county support of any land acquisition. The Fox Lake Conservation League is a local club with over 400 members and is very active in land acquisition. We were a 2016, 2018, 2019 and 2020 LSOHC grant recipient. I'm very pleased to say that our 2016 grant is 100% spent, and the 2018 and 19 appropriations have each purchased two parcels from the fee acquisition budgets and are 98 and 94% spent. We are active also in the DNR, CPL, and ECPA grant programs as well. Engineering on our four parcels recently purchased is ongoing, and these wetland and grassland restorations will continue in 2021. We have also two parcels being appraised with our most recent 2000. What's that?
Doug, I don't know what's going on.
Somebody's talking about a baby shower.
Are you there, Doug?
Yeah, I was somebody on. I'm unmuted now, but.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mark.
Yeah, I think, Doug, are you live streaming on the YouTube site? Because if you are, that's a few minute delay, and that might actually be from during our break.
All right, Doug, go ahead.
All right, I'm here. Where did you last, where did I leave off? Because I'm totally lost here.
I think we all are. You were working, you had 400 members. That's the last thing
okay.
I remember.
So we're, our current budget's in the 2020, we have two parcels that are being appraised with our current grant. So, you know, essentially we need more money to continue our great successful land acquisition program in Martin County. And the, if you heard the, my previous testimony next, I have Emily Nelson from the Conservation Fund ready to testify.
Hey, Emily, go ahead.
Thanks, Doug. Sorry about the technical difficulties to the council there. My name is Emily Nelson. I'm the Minnesota representative with the Conservation Fund. And one of the topics that has come up in past council meetings regarding acquisition projects is how do we make sure we're moving the needle or getting the most bang for our conservation buck? At the outset of this partnership back in 2016, the three of us on this call, along with the DNR and other active conservation partners working in Martin County, we all sat down over the course of three meetings and analyze the places in the county that one, already had existing public lands to build off of, two, had strong data to support wildlife's preference of a particular area, and three, had the strongest return on investment estimates. And the result is that map that Doug mentioned as our PA-10 supplemental handout that we sent around before the meeting. And we're targeting these conservation complexes for protection and restoration because of the high potential biological value they will create compared to other areas that would potentially be more expensive and result in less habitat benefits. So back to the Conservation Fund, we again are responsible for the entire real estate transaction process in the program, which is our area of expertise. And we've successfully protected four of the priority WMA properties over the last year alone. It's been a busy year for all of us. Fox Lake Conservation League then takes title to the property at closing, and Ducks Unlimited is the restoration partner. And I'll now hand it off to John Lindstrom with DU to talk more about the restoration aspects of the program.
And John, you have 30 seconds, I'm sorry.
No problem. Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the council. As my predecessor said, I'm John Lindstrom with Ducks Unlimited. We're the restoration partner on this grant. We have about $1 million in our proposal to restore these prairie pothole complexes in coordination with DNR and the conservation group Emily mentioned. It's a really cool laser-focused group in Martin County that Doug and his counterparts locally have really worked hard to steward locals to support the program. So that's probably my 30 seconds, and we can take any questions now.
Great. Are there questions? Any questions from members? Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Doug, nobody argues with the need for grassland down in Martin County. I'm a little amazed that there's no contributing funds there. There's nobody's chipping in anything locally or whatever. Have you tried to get those? Can you explain that? Because I'd feel a lot better if more people were contributing.
You know, essentially, Ron, we're using the bulk of our habitat budgets in the CPL and ECP programs, $50,000, $60,000 a year. We're supplementing for match for those, and we just don't have a ton more in our budget. So we're utilizing what match money we have for other grant programs at this time.
So when I was reading sorry, Ron, did you have a follow-up question? Apparently not. Dan, go ahead, and then I'll ask my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be kind of a follow-up to Member Shara's question. And Doug, I've been a big supporter of the work that you guys do down there. And I too have concerns about local match, particularly when DU is involved. And Ron mentioned this a year ago when we went through this process. I'm curious to know from Mr. Lindstrom how much money a DU raises in the state of Minnesota through your different banquets and fundraisers, and how much money you actually spend out of those dollars on habitat restoration, enhancement, and acquisition.
Thanks, Senator Fabian and Representative Fabian and members of the council. I don't have those numbers available to me right now. That's something I could get to you, but I know in the past, my supervisor, John Schneider, has helped explain the way our program works too, and how we can't necessarily steer funds locally as easily as some other conservation entities. But that's, if you're looking for numbers, Representative, I can, or we rather, DU, that is, follow up with you after the call when we compile that information.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, one other quick comment to question to the group. Emily, Ms. Nelson, excuse me, you talked about moving the needle. I've talked a lot about accessibility on WMAs. What is your group doing? And Doug, you guys, what are you going to do to make these things to have a conversation with DNR to make them more accessible to people with severe handicap issues?
Doug, if you want to take this, I can start. Thank you, Representative Fagan, for that question. Much of the land, well, all of the land in these programs are going to be donated to the DNR as part of the WMA program within Martin County. And Doug, if you've been having any local conversations with the WMA managers there regarding accessibility, please feel free to chime in.
Yeah, Representative Fabian, I know one of our WMAs, we a few years ago worked with accessibility for a deer blind for a wheelchair accessibility on the Seymour Lake WMA. But, you know, each WMA is separate, and, you know, we would fully support better access for our handicapped hunters and et cetera. So.
Doug, I was wondering, when I looked at the proposal, I couldn't see a restoration cost. Is it embedded in your acquisition cost?
The separate DU budget, excuse me, Chairman Hartwell, the acquisition is in my budget, where all the restoration and wetland and grassland budgets are in the DU budget. So they are separate.
Other questions? I guess that's about it. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, all.
We'll go back to PA09 and hope that John is online. Amanda, is John with us? There's John. John, unmute yourself and then you can begin.
Good morning, Chairman Hartwell and council members. I'm John Schneider from Ducks Unlimited. I direct our conservation programs in Minnesota. With me today too are Tom Kerr of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Aaron Sandquist of Pheasants Forever. I apologize for the delay. I was in the waiting room, but kept waiting.
Yeah, it's not a problem.
I'm pleased to present phase three proposal for our ongoing partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Pheasants Forever and private landowners to protect and restore working land, prairie, and wetlands in west central Minnesota with federal habitat conservation easements. This is phase three of an ongoing partnership to accelerate the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service conservation easement program that was started many years ago and is delivered throughout Minnesota and the Dakotas. For decades, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has protected and restored prairie and wetlands by purchasing habitat conservation easements, which are working lands conservation easements. Now, these are not new, but they are unique in the way that they allow grazing and delayed hay cutting after July 15th, which is the end of the primary bird nesting season. This program fills an important niche by allowing grazing and delayed hay cutting usage of the land while it remains in private ownership. And this also helps with vegetation management too by limiting trees and other invasive plants. We focus these easements on lands near other permanent easements and publicly held lands, so they fill in the protected wildlife habitat gaps that are on the landscape. This program is so popular among private landowners that do not desire to fully restrictive easements that don't allow any use or that don't want to sell their land. And so the demand for this program currently far outweighs current federal funding available. So to help, DU and PF propose to use state outdoor heritage grant funds to purchase easements for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service using the service's federal easement payment schedule and easement template, and temporarily hold the easement after we record them until they can be transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for long-term federal easement monitoring and enforcement. Importantly, DU and PF will also use state outdoor heritage grant funds to restore prairie and wetlands on these 3,000 acres of lands that we ease, and also restore an additional 300 acres of other lands that the service directly eases independent of this partnership. To be clear, DU and PF will directly purchase and record these easements and then immediately begin transferring them to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will then conduct long-term monitoring, management, and enforcement. They've committed to holding these easements forever, frankly, and doing the easement stewardship at no cost to the state or the Outdoor Heritage Fund. As noted in the DU handout, I'm pleased to report that DU and PF have spent 57% of our 2018 Phase 1 grant and have protected 89% of our easement acre goal so far, and we're very confident we'll surpass our acre goal by the end of the the year. We've also started delivering our Laws of 2020 Phase 2 grant in July too, and have several easements that we're working on. We plan to purchase a few more easements over the next 10 months to exceed our Phase 1 goal and then start focusing on restoration while also starting to buy Phase 2 easements So we'll be in need of funding again next year. We will be completely spent out of phase one easement grant funds by this time next year and well into phase two by this time next year. So we're looking forward to continuing the program further. For more information on these easements and our partnership with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm pleased to introduce Tom Kerr, Refuge Supervisor for Minnesota and Iowa with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Good morning, Chairman Hartwell and council members. I'm Tom Kerr with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And today I'd just like to start off by saying that the Fish and Wildlife Support Service really appreciates the support from the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council through the Outdoor Heritage Fund for the Habitat Easement Program. And we look forward to continuing to work with Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever in implementing this program to accelerate the Habitat Easement Program in Minnesota. As John said, we continue to have strong landowner interest in the program with a list of over 150 landowners interested in easements in western Minnesota. These easements fill an important part of the habitat puzzle, really complementing many of the other protected areas on the landscape. Haying and grazing also provides important disturbances that simulate the natural processes that occurred on the landscape, whether that was wildfire or grazing by bison or elk or other herbivores. So these disturbances are important in maintaining grasslands and preventing tree invasions in the prairie region of the state. Just to follow up on something else John said too, once the easements are transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we take over long-term management and enforcement of the easements at no stewardship cost to the state. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a long history of easement management in Minnesota, acquiring the first Fish and Wildlife Service easements in the early 1960s. So we have a long history of following through and enforcing the provisions of the easements. So thank you again for your support for accelerating the Habitat Easement Program. And we'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Great, thank you both. Questions? Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Kerr. The haying and grazing, as we've been told and know, is a benefit to, can be a benefit to prairies. Can also be a slippery slope, as I've witnessed in South Dakota and other places where walk-in areas, they allowed them to hay and a mouse couldn't live in there after they were done. And you say you enforce these. What happens if a landowner says, I'm not gonna take my cows out when you said, I'm gonna hay more than you said or whatever. Are they hauled to court or what happens? Those are nice words. Hey, we enforce that, but I'm curious what the enforcement look like?
Yeah, thank you. So for enforcement, I could give you a scenario. You know, our haying is that haying cannot occur until after July 15th. So if a landowner went in and hayed, say they went in June 15th and decided to hay the entire property, then what we would do is we would have a manager contact them. And frankly, if it's the first offense, we would really work with them, make sure they understood the requirements of the easement. And then if it was something where they were like, you know what, I screwed up, we won't do it again. You know, we make a note in the files, and then we watch that one in the future. If they came back in and did it again the second year, then we would have the option at that point of taking them to court, basically, you know, issuing them a ticket for violating the terms of the easement. So that's how we treat it. We try to work in partnership with the landowners, realizing that, you know, maybe they misunderstood it. We're going to work with them. We're going to move forward. And our real goal here is habitat protection.
So what's the consequence of the ticket?
So the consequence of the ticket would either be a fine, or if it goes to court, then the judge could also put a fine on them too, of a different amount. So there's a standard collateral amount. I don't know how much it is. But that's what the result would be. And then in the future, if there's future violations, then that gives us a lot more strength to work with the assistant U.S. attorney to get a harsher penalty, just to make sure that they follow the terms of the easement.
Other questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next we'll do PA 11, Rim Grassland Reserve, Phase 3. John? John, unmute yourself and then go ahead.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone.
Great. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chairman Hartwell and council members. I'm here to talk about our phase three for the Rim Grassland Reserve Program, where our goal is for 23 acres statewide, or approximately 1,800 acres. I don't have a handout, but this time I tried a new innovative approach, and I mailed some wildflowers and native grass arrangements out to all the council members, and I'm hoping everybody received them. Just to give you an idea of how beautiful the prairie is right now, this time of the year, these plants were all, beautiful. These plants were all collected on rim easement sites. They weren't collected on remnants. But if you, I kind of picked ones that were very aromatic. You may recognize a lot of them. I mean, some of you may know more about grass identification and wildflower ID, but my particular favorite is the giant blue hyssop, which kind of smells like licorice. It looks like the seed head of the top of a switchgrass. That's sand drop seed. That smells like cilantro. But if you kind of ruffle up the arrangement, kind of rough it up with your fingers, it kind of brings out some of the smell. So that was my attempt to kind of just to show you some of the great, unique, and beautiful flowers and grass that we have on some of our sites throughout Minnesota. This is phase one, and phase two have gone very, very well. Landowners are very interested in the program. I think we've reached both phase one and phase two goals. We've closed our first easement on phase one, and that will be reported soon. But I think the overall success is working with the local technical teams. A lot of those folks are Soil and Water Conservation District staff. And when landowners walk in to the farm service centers, many times they're asking if they qualify for CRP. And as many of you know, you have cropland. This is another program that you can offer to landowners. People have been very, we're offering a non-crop program, and they're very welcoming with that. To qualify for rim grasslands, you have to have some sort of remnant prairie of moderate quality. The very high quality stuff, we basically transfer or move that to the native prairie bank staff, but our target is moderate that we can improve with management. So we're doing a lot of interesting projects that are either adjacent to Native Prairie Bank easements or are protecting areas that typically wouldn't be funded under the Prairie Bank. So our request of $8 million would launch this program into the future. It's becoming more and more attractive to landowners. I do have, Sharon Doucette, our RIM easement section manager, is in the waiting room if there's any questions for her. But in a nutshell, that is my proposal. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
Sure, questions? Any questions from members?
I've got one, Mark Holston.
Okay, sorry, Mark.
Nope. John, I'm looking at the last page of the second to the last, towards the end of our handouts. And, you know, this is the one where it says 2020 expiring CRP acres in Minnesota. And clearly there's a big percentage of those expiring CRP acres are in the northern half of the state. You know, I'm just kind of looking at the proposal and I'm trying to get a handle on, is there a targeted area where, I mean, you've got the whole western half of the state from Canada down to Iowa as the target area. But where would do you think most of these 1,800 acres are going to settle out at?
Generally, they'd be in the northwest part of Minnesota because there's larger tracts of remnant prairie.
Okay.
And we have been getting some interest in that area. Surprisingly, we're getting a lot of interest in areas south of the Minnesota River Valley, which surprised me. But the payment rates that we use are all based on township values of non-crop rate. And those rates, they get smaller as you go north, northwest. So what just typically comes in is people that are, you know, don't qualify for CRP, they're kind of stuck in a sense if they want to go into a program and protect some of their property.
Other questions? All right, John, thank you very much.
All right, have a good day, everyone. Thank you.
So, members, we managed to plow through that pretty quickly. From what I can see, we have finished for the day other than a discussion among ourselves about how today went and any comments or questions that people had, discussions we want to have among ourselves. Did I do everything all right? What would you have liked me to have done differently? No comments.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Anytime you get done an hour and a half early, it's a good job by the chairman, okay?
Only if you get what you need, Dave.
Well, we'll find that out later.
Dan, you have a comment.
Same thing that David did, but I do want one point of clarification. The report that we're going to get from Sandy Smith, we're going to get that before the allocation, correct?
That is what I requested from her. So Sandy, tell me that.
Yeah, no, I will have that to you guys by Friday. We were 2 weeks delayed this year because our online management system, we migrated to a new system, so that we were shut down for 2 weeks, and so things are a little bit delayed, but I will get that to everybody by Friday.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah. And then to just follow up the conversation that you and I and Member Holston were having before we came back from break. And, you know, us moving forward, there is a fair amount of time left that we have in order to be able to get our recommendations to the legislature. So I just want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence. And, you know, if we need to, we can certainly get together in October and November if that's the case. But I just want to make sure that, and I use the term rushed in our conversation, it may not be the right term, but I just want to make sure that we're comfortable with what we're doing. So if we need to slow things down a little bit, I'm very, very willing to do that. But interested in hearing other people's comments.
All right, others? Tom?
Mr. Chair, I'm sensitive to what Representative Fabian says, but if we get going like we are right now, is it possible that tomorrow, if we do as well as we did today, that we could ask a couple of the Wednesday participants to get her done? And I mean, if nothing else, it might give us some time, more time to discuss on Thursday.
I am open to doing that if we can make it work, Tom.
Yeah,
we'll see how it goes tomorrow.
Okay.
Denny.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to echo Senators or Member Saxhog's point. I'm wondering if we shouldn't put at least a half a dozen or so of the folks, if they're able to be in reserve, that were supposed to come in Wednesday morning to potentially be available for Tuesday. Because our biggest discussion was that first part of the CPL stuff. And without that happening tomorrow, I got a feeling that we're going to go pretty quick. And I make the assumption, and I think it's probably true, that we're all doing so much good research ahead of time that the need for questions is not quite as strong.
So I will work with staff to see if we can make that happen. Mark, sure. You have a
Mark. Yeah, no, I just want to restate that. I it's hard for me to admit that Denny McNamara was right, but this went really well. I thought, and I think he is right in that the amount of research I've done on the front end, reading through the materials and going through stuff, really helped me for the hearings. But I was pleased with how well it actually went this morning. That's it.
Great. Are there any comments on specific proposals? Ashley.
I guess the main thing I wanted to point out is just, you know, it's kind of similarly to last year, same organization from project to project has significantly different DSS numbers. And so I don't know if there's a way to just get clarification from some of those organizations where they have multiple proposals and the DSS numbers are so wildly different between them. You know, so like a couple of TNCs projects differ between 18%, 10%, back to 19%. So I don't know. I'm just curious if there's a way that staff can help us get an idea from the different organizations. Like they clarify how they come up with their DSS numbers, but it's still unclear to me how that varies so much from project to project.
I think we can ask staff, but my guess would be that DSS on acquisition dollars is very different than DSS fees on staff dollars. You don't need to pile on if you're doing an acquisition the way you need it to cover your staff costs on a restoration basis. But Mark, do you have any thoughts or anyone else on staff? Joe? I was right, huh? That's all he wants to say. So Ashley, is there something specific you would like, or is that explanation enough for you?
So that's enough for an explanation of the differences. I think, you know, I'm also trying to get a handle on, do we as a council have a standard for a certain amount that we're shooting for, depending on the type of proposal?
That's a completely different question, and we do not. We've pretty much at this point let everybody do what they think is right with DSS, which is subject on some level to the DNR oversight when it's a non-DNR Bowser application. That is a discussion we could have. We could simply say, we're going to allow no more than X percent for DSS. We don't care how you calculate it. We have chosen not to do that to this point. That doesn't mean we couldn't do it. It's probably a challenge to do it in this round, having given no one advance notice. But it's certainly something worthy of discussion. Mark, you're online. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, your explanation, as Joe gave you a thumbs up, was correct. very appropriate. The discussion about whether DSS has been is something that the council should put a maximum on or not has been kind of an ongoing thing as long as I've been here. And there are some, on the benefit side, it does create a cap. On the negative side, it might create also a floor where those who aren't asking as much DSS come up. I don't know which would happen, but for quite some time, the council has been back and forth on it, and it really wouldn't be a bad idea to have a conversation in the future. That also provides, as Member Holston was mentioning earlier, kind of a deeper conversation of a higher level item, in this case, DSS. One more thing, the chair is correct. It would be very tough to have that this time of the year for these appropriations or recommendations. It would be better if we're looking at it for the forward.
So, Mark, I'd like to ask you to put that as an agenda item for future meetings, something that we could set up and have a good discussion on for the future. And Ashley, thank you for bringing it up again. Other comments, questions? Jamie.
Thank you. Just in general, as we've gone through the proposals today, there was some discussion earlier this morning on overlapping projects. And I think one thing that I've noted for myself is to take a much closer look at that. The question that I ask kind of rhetorically to myself and to the group too is, why wouldn't we put more funds to those NGOs who can realize the matching funds compared to straight funding of some of the state-sponsored programs? If we can get some of that match for, say, funding a WMA through one party compared to another party, I'm putting those in higher value than just having the straight funding. And so that's one thing I'm taking a look at. I don't know if anybody else had any comments or thoughts on that I wanted to share.
Great, thank you. I would just say, you know, it is confusing when everybody's allegedly working together, but we don't see that. We just see proposals. Let us do WMAs, let us do this in partnership with. It's really hard to understand what everyone's individual role is and how it fits together in the matrix and why we're seeing proposals that have that overlap, which may not actually be overlap, but feels like it. Other thoughts? I just a clarification, the Fox League proposal in Martin County, I specifically asked them about restoration dollars, which they said were embedded in various budgets, but their output tables show zero for restoration in terms of allocation of dollars, which is a concern to me since their proposal says they're going to do restoration. So we maybe should ask them for a clarification of that, which I tried to do, but was told that I was looking at it wrong. I couldn't pull it up fast enough, but the output table shows zero for acres or dollars of restoration. Other thoughts? I would just say, following up on Jamie's question, the WMA and SNA proposal, the note I wrote in the notes section to me was, it seems like there's so many WMA proposals, maybe this should just be an SNA proposal, because we're not seeing any other proposals that mention SNAs, which there clearly is a need for SNA funding. And that was the note I put in the side, and probably what my allocation will show in my notes section. Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in the Fox, in the Martin County proposal, if you look on page 4 of their proposal, their contract work with DU is for the restoration work. That was the way I understood it, that all the money going to DU will be for the restoration work, so that there's the $7 million of the $9 million proposal is for fee acquisition, and then the almost $2 million, 1.8 of DU was the restoration work, and that's the way I understood it, Mr. Chair. And then I did have a second point to make after.
Yeah, I think you're right. But their output table shows $0 for restoration and 0 acres for restoration. And that's what had me confused. Mark, did you have a comment to this?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair and Denny. Just to, it falls in line with Denny. When we have acquisitions, remember within those acquisitions, you also have restoration or enhancement, but it's not counted separately, because we don't want to count it as a, it'd be a double input of the acres, and it'd be double counting of acres that way. So the acquisition, fee title acquisition could actually be the fee title and the restoration, and it's just covered under the acreage for fee title acquisition. It's not listed separately in restoration.
Joe, you had a question, comment.
Mr. Chair and members, this is Joe. Mark is correct. So you only report the acquisitions. All of the acquisitions are restored. It's just that those acres are not reported, so there'd be a double counting of acres. So the total footprint, if somebody was going to buy 100 acres and that was farm field that needed to be restored, they would only report 100 acres. But the accomplishment plan would tell you that 100 acres was also restored. It's just, it would be a double counting because the footprint total would be 100 acres.
Okay, thank you. Denny, you had another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is interesting, and just to take a minute to discuss, like the Martin County and so many of the proposals actually deal with purchases of WMAs or WPAs. And I think, you know, I don't know if there's a good clean answer or why some are just a straight DNR and other ones use a different group. Clearly some people don't want to deal with the DNR, or they have a relationship with somebody personally, like the local group down in Martin County. And it's for us as a group to decide how we think it's best to allocate it. But I would say Martin County, the Fox Glen group, the local conservation club down there, has decided they're better to jump in on their own and work hard. And I think history would show that Martin County is getting a disproportionate amount of WMA money because of their hard work. And we've allocated it accordingly, good, bad, or indifferent. I think it's a good point to make. I mean, one local WMA near me down by Red Wing, the John Peter Hoffman one, it was Nature Conservancy actually acquired that 27 acres. And the reality that I'm a little bit familiar with that group, there was some really hard feelings with some local residents there towards different groups or towards each other. And maybe some way, somehow, Nature Conservancy was able to break that. So I think we just have to kind of juggle all those different things going on in our own mind of how we allocate it. You, Mr. Chair, made a mention, one other one just real quick, then I'm done, on SNAs. I personally think that's a great funding through LCCMR, and that the WMAs seem to work better here. And I certainly support some SNAs from here, but sometimes they have restrictions that aren't totally consistent with Lasard SAM's funding. Thank you.
Mark, you have a...
Yeah, I just, I think it's important for everyone to remember when Jay was speaking about the DNR WMAs, is that they really coordinate with the different organizations and groups so that when projects are identified, if there's an organization, a local group or not NGO who wants to take the lead, DNR will, they'll let them take the lead. And so what I heard from Jay was these parcels were ones that kind of are in between. It's not that they didn't have value. It's not that they didn't, they weren't significant. It's just that they didn't fall in PF's niche or Martin County's niche or somebody's niche. And then geographically, they're a little bit spread out a little differently. But I just wanted to make that point. It's not a, I think there's a bigger, a long-term discussion that needs to take place. And I think DNR is probably going to be having some of those if they're not already having them, about why can't they just transfer this over to those groups and let them manage the WMA acquisition. From a cost perspective, they're evaluating their budgets all the time. And I would think this might be something that they're dealing with internally now. That doesn't help right now. With this project, help us, but I'm just saying long-term, I think there's a bigger long-term debate or discussion on different organizations might be better suited to go do acquisitions.
So maybe this is another assignment for staff for future hearings that we have or discussions, that we ask the DNR to come in and talk about perhaps with partners why they're using partners or not using partners in different areas and what's the most efficient way to handle it to get the biggest bang for the buck. Is that essentially what you were saying, Mark Holston?
Well, yeah, I know that's what they're doing. I mean, they're aggressively working with those groups and letting others take the lead when it's appropriate, and just to maximize effort out on the landscape. They don't have to be the lead on everything all the time. And I think that is a management strategy that's gone on for years now.
Okay. Well, maybe it would be helpful to have the DNR come in and explain how they reach those decisions for everyone's. You've obviously sat on the inside and understand that, where many of us haven't had the exposure, and it's probably worthwhile for this group to understand how the decisions of who should do what get made and why we're seeing different proposals. Other comments? Anything you would like me to do differently tomorrow in terms of chairing the meeting? Anything I did that was really good or not so good? All right. Well, thank you for saying nothing, I guess. I will work with staff so we can tee up some people and let them know if we run ahead of schedule, we can bring people from Wednesday into the discussion tomorrow. And assuming that's also works, we'll start notifying the Thursday presenters that they might think about Wednesday, and we'll see where we get to. So thank you all. Have a great rest of the day. We will see you tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock or 7:50, so that we're all online by 8 o'clock and get going. So thanks very much.